Now you have the opportunity to buy a unique poster containing a screenshot of every single millennial stream ever. The entire smorgasbord, the full gamut, the whole shebang, all in one incredible display commemorating the first decade of this festival. Available in portrait or landscape. Buy yours now.
Hello and welcome to the England Banquet of Millennial X. I should say that these are it's an experimental format. I might do them each year. If I do, there'll be different themes for each one. Like, I know that some people wanted an Irish banquet, but there were only five slots, so I couldn't do that this year. Maybe next year. So the idea is that to bring people together and have a relaxed, informal sort of chat. So welcome everyone. That this is I have Dan the Iconoclast, Horace, and Bo History Bro, known from the Lotus Eaters and from his own channel as well. So welcome everyone.
Hi, all right.
Thank you for agreeing to appear. Now, if there are any other, because I did invite about 15 people to this, English content creators, but not many seem to be up for it. So if you're watching and you are an English content creator and we're in good standing, then you can DM me on Twitter or Telegram if you'd like to join.
If it's me that's the problem, I'll drop out for being a fish.
You're so controversial, Horace. You just rub everyone up the wrong way.
It's obnoxious,
But I should make a special welcome to the Iconoclast, who is a fan favorite. Many people asked me to invite you on. I think you were on 2 years ago on Millennial.
Yeah, well, 2021, yeah. I think, last time. Yeah,
right. Yeah, definitely 21. Yeah, well, welcome back to Millennial. It seems crazy that it's been 3 years.
Yeah, time seems to just continue to go quicker and quicker. I don't understand it myself. By the way, before this stream was officially live, I thought we were live, and I said, oh, happy Hanukkah, everyone, as a joke. So I just want to say happy Hanukkah as an introductory joke. Exactly. Yeah.
It's never brilliant.
Brilliant, yes. Thank you for laughing. Amazing. I wasted it, and it was funny at the time, but now it's not. That's the way it goes. Time goes quick. Yes,
right. Yeah.
I've got a prepared joke. Can I use that now as well?
Yes.
I'm so not calling Twitter X that I've decided to call Millennial X Millennial Twitter.
Ah, brilliant. Fantastic. Brilliant. Taking it to the...
It's a variation on an earlier joke from a while ago that I heard. I'm so not calling Twitter X that I'm going to start calling Malcolm X Malcolm Twitter.
Wow. That's quite funny.
Colin, you should get a soundboard so whenever these hot jokes get told, you can just do like a boom, tsh, we are funny guys.
Yes. You should be a Disney double act. Iconoclast and horror.
See us in the new Snow White film coming 2025. Big time.
Well, that is a big deal. It's as far as I know, they've spent about at least 200 million on that. I think more, maybe by now. And she keeps mouthing off And yeah. they're now very worried that the film's just going to bomb. So they're sort of delaying the inevitable by continually changing the delaying its release. But she just keeps doing it. So I think in the end, they can't possibly salvage it. It's going to be a fucking disaster.
It's going to be hilarious. And History Bros here. I saw History Bro on a Critical Drinker live stream a few weeks ago. I can't remember when it was. And I enjoy I've told you this, Colin, previously, but I love watching film review YouTube. It's kind of my guilty pleasure. I don't feel guilty about it, but I like doing it. And
I did a lot of that this year with the Doctor Who stuff research for the. I did a set of essays about it, so I got into it then in my own way. I get it. It is enjoyable because they're constantly. It's like they're spewing hatred for something that you also hate. So it's kind of enjoyable.
you almost want all these things to be just terrible, so you can see the YouTube creators do their thing. You know, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, Star Wars is dead, and there's more people who are making money off shit on Star Wars these days, rightfully so.
I quite often go on Mr. H Reviews channel, Nate of Mr. H Reviews, and
He's great. I like him.
Yeah, he's brilliant. We've had him on Late Seats a couple of times, and it's always a treat, always a pleasure and a treat to get on Drinker. But it's almost too easy now. Like they're pumping out so much shit. I mean, so much diabolically poor writing and stuff that it's a bit like shooting fish in a barrel, really. But what's surprising to me, or perhaps it isn't surprising, but the amount of crossover between just political analysts and TV film reviewers, it's just a natural both ways as well. People that do actual politics stuff and history stuff, naturally, I know I have, would talk about films and TV and culture. And the other way, a lot of creators that do culture and TV and films actually want to talk about politics as yeah. well. And so anyway, the Venn diagram of those two things are, I think they overlap massively.
Yeah, I've said this before, but before I started the Iconoclast on YouTube back in the day, I did have a film review channel in like 2015 or something. Mm-hmm. And it didn't go anywhere. I had like 80 subscribers or something. Really poor. Yeah. But wait, you see what it was like back then, and then you look at it now. Holy shit! These guys are doing crazy numbers. They're out. They've got bigger viewership than Netflix. These guys, and it's all because the mainstream media output is just terrible. And
it's like people enjoy the critiquing more than the actual thing itself.
I do enjoy it, especially
it's just frustrating.
Especially at Christmas time, Wars, at this time of year when everyone's not really doing anything, everyone's just kind of calming down. I do enjoy a good video essay. I really do. video essay. It's good.
Someone like Drinker is so big. I mean, I don't want to unnecessarily kiss his ass here, but it's just a reality. It's just a fact that he's so big that it's like he's bigger than any sort of mainstream media critic. Like he's Barry Norman big, you know. People actually listen to what he's, you know, it's not just... I don't know. It's maybe it's surprising. Maybe it shouldn't be. But all credit to him.
Yeah, I enjoy it, and it's good that you because you're on the Lotus Eaters, and that's your domain. You do the politics stuff, but then you cross over, and I think Carl's been on Critical Drinker as well at some point.
Yeah,
there is that crossover Bo's there,
also,
and it,
yeah. Sorry, Bo's also been on Mystery H, Mr. H Reviews.
Yeah, a bunch of times, most weeks now.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Az, you know, Hill versus Babyface. To Maulers Good, you know, the EFAP.
My God, you need to hook me up. I love these guys. I would have I won't abuse my thing. It doesn't matter. I enjoy watching it. That's all I'll say. It's good. Very good.
Yeah, no, I love to review a film. And, it's always easier to tear something down than build something up. But there is something... nice about just ripping the absolute granny out of something, some really terrible woke leftist propaganda. There's something satisfying about it.
So the Doctor Who thing, Colin, I didn't, because I've never been a Doctor Who fan. Is the Doctor Black
now? I wish I could say the same.
Is he a black guy now?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I haven't, because I didn't look it up. I just thought, oh, well.
It's as bad as it could be. It's as bad as you can imagine. It's worse than you can imagine, believe me.
It's fucking dreadful.
I thought it was going to happen because, you know, they always say, oh, the next Bond's going to be fucking a black guy or at this point an Indian probably.
Yeah, do you want to see the new Doctor Who?
Please, I can't wait.
Great.
It's mad.
what mad. Is this?
It is Nkuti Gatwa.
Comedy name as well. Great, yeah, cool.
You say that again in English, please. What is this?
Well, it's actually a Scottish name because he was born in Edinburgh. I think he was born in Rwanda, grew up in Edinburgh or something. I can't actually remember.
So he's as Scottish as Hamza Yusuf and Anas Sawa. Yeah, right.
Yes, exactly. And this is him with the producer of the program.
Brilliant.
What's his name? Moffat? Is that his
name? No. This is Russell T. Davis.
Oh, yeah, that's the one. Sorry. Yeah,
and this is the big thing. This is why I did the series of essays. Russell T. Davis is the guy who brought it back in 2005 mm-hmm. to great success. I mean, I didn't like it, but it was very successful. And so it interested me that he's been brought back now in 2022 and brought and revamped the show again because it was flailing hugely. So they've brought him back thinking that it'll be a great success again. He'll just work his magic again. And instead he's just absolutely fucked it. And so that fascinated me. The question of how is it that the second time around, this guy has done the opposite of what he did the first time around. So that was the question. And, yeah, it ended up being seven essays to investigate that, but there was a lot to say. Sorry, Bo.
Sorry, I'd say he wants to get himself checked for monkeypox after dealing with that. Yeah, I follow this because I do Mr. H reviews and stuff. I follow it fairly closely. And not only is he obviously a DEI hire, but he says he does all those things in interviews. Hitting all the anti-white talking points and being just a race baiter and sort of ultra, ultra hardline pro-gay partisan.
Obviously.
This is the title for this and the cover image for the essays, just so that people know. But yeah, sorry, Bo, I interrupted you.
Yeah. No, I interrupted you. Please do carry on.
Well, I don't want to go on about it because it's not of interest to most people, right? But I would emphasize this is not a program that I like. I haven't liked it since 1989. Although I don't
Which
mind
was
the
Sylvester
McGann.
McCoy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Although I think the McGann movie was all right. It was a lot better than it could have been. But whatever. So my interest in this is sociological. And so there was a lot to see. There was an awful lot to see. And it's a very, because it's just a car crash. You're sort of analyzing how could this fuck up so badly? It's so much worse than it needed to. it could have just been, you know, crap. But instead it was uber toxic disaster. So yeah, it was very interesting. I got a lot out of writing that. But someone mentioned your Substack, Horace. So I should see something that I haven't implemented with these is to have people's links in the description. So sorry about that, everyone. But if you go to the Millennial website, you will see the links for all of the people who are appearing here. So it will be there.
I like Substack. It's good. Good sign.
Well, we can talk about that.
Bit exclusive for Bo and Dan not being on there, though. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. I mean, not everyone is going to take to that format. It's the same way that, you know, there are different. Yeah, we coincided, all of us, on YouTube, but you know, we came from different things and we went on to different things. It's Substack is definitely something that I think I should always have. I mean, I should always have been writing. It was something that I always wanted to do, but it was a matter of finding a platform that seemed to take it seriously, and Substack was the first one.
I'll give you one sign that things have really changed. I was on YouTube. I actually did YouTube videos in about 2016, but nobody from this scene would have seen my videos. It was tiny. And then I started making videos in 2019, but then I got banned the following year around early on in the lockdowns. But recently I applied about, well, it was a few months ago, I applied to get my YouTube channel back. And they gave me back, like, almost immediately, within about an hour of applying, I had it back. So I have my YouTube channel back now. But I don't want to use it. I don't have any particular ideas, like, unless I want to start making videos again. But even then, I've seen what they do. Like, I mean, I've seen with Bo's channel, like, he makes quality content. And YouTube, they just want you to watch either unboxing videos, makeup, CNN, BBC, whatever. They don't want you to watch good content. And I just don't see, it's unattractive. It's an unattractive prospect now, even though it feels, you know, for a long time, it felt like YouTube was the place where, if you're making videos, that's where you go to reach the public. Like with Twitter, it's a, you know, if you're into politics, you go to reach the public, right? YouTube doesn't seem like that anymore. It doesn't seem like an opportunity to me anymore. It doesn't seem exciting. It seems like a place where your content just dies and just gets shouted down by whatever YouTube wants to promote.
I wonder if that's only true for the likes of us. I wonder if it's still possible for us. I mean, I know you're definitely right that as a politics, it's dead. It's a ghost town for politics. Yeah. But I
it
wonder.
It feels like there's such a hostile company. It feels like it's completely hostile to, not to everyone, not to, like, I don't know, Taylor Swift probably does well out of it, or, you know, or whatever, but. The people like us, it seems like actually almost pointless to go on. I notice, I mean, Lotus Eaters is doing all right though, isn't it? But I mean, Lotus Eaters gets decent views on YouTube.
The way we demonetized everything Lotus Eaters, apart from one of our newer channels, it got demonetized ages ago because they, Sargon of Akkad main channel was demonetized. And after doing Lotus Eaters for 6 months or a year or whatever, someone somewhere in, no doubt in California, saw that it was, you know, like a Cole Benjamin project or something. And they literally said, we didn't get any strikes or anything. They just said, no, you're demonetized. It's attached to this one that's already demonetized, and therefore you're demonetized. So in the first little bit of Lotus Eaters, we're making good money, but then the margins became very tight and we had to start doing other revenue streams because we were just demonetized literally in an instant by YouTube. Yeah, they're scum. And
it's instantaneous. It's like blue-haired tit presses a button on a screen somewhere.
They could just turn it off. They could just move the goalposts whenever they want and apply things retrospectively. So at Lotus Eaters, we don't really censor ourselves much apart from for YouTube, right? Rumble allows anything, Odyssey allows it within reason. You know, Rumble's cool, Odyssey's cool, whatever, BitChute's cool. Twitter doesn't really give a shit about nearly anything.
Except people put
snuff video, don't they, on fucking Twitter. Porn, it's horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
But YouTube, like, we'll do something, we'll do a bit of content, and then someone will go, there was that one spicy thing you said, we'll have to get one of the production people to cut that out for YouTube. And it's just a massive ball ache, because even though we're demonetized, it's still... YouTube is still such the dominant video sharing platform that we still want to engage with it, have to engage with it, really, even though we don't make money off the videos. But it's still a massive thing, right? So we just have to be careful. Like, there's certain things, when COVID was a thing, you had to be really careful. There was a period when you couldn't really suggest that the American election 2020 was stolen. All sorts of shit. You have to be really careful about talking about trannies. Really careful. Like, even just saying the word tranny is like, oh, should we cut that out? It's ridiculous. YouTube is a state.
See, I don't see the word tranny even as derogatory. It's more sort of humorous.
Right, yeah.
It's funny.
It is a funny word. It's fun to say as well, tranny.
Yeah. It's fun. So I'm not really sure. But
yeah,
I guess,
you're fucking tranny. Come on. Yeah, it's great.
Exactly. But yeah,
I don't want to do myself out about YouTube. Like, I'm pleased to see Substack because you can do videos on Substack now. I just think there is an opportunity to gradually erode that, you know, 99% or whatever that YouTube have got of the video market. I mean, even now, there's still something like 99%. It's terrible. Like, Rumble and Odyssey together have barely made a scratch yet. Even though Rumble's on the NASDAQ now, Rumble got a massive investment the other day as well, but it's still tiny compared to YouTube. But I just think Google has become probably the number one enemy in the world, you know, along with, like, maybe the American state and the British state and stuff. But it's like, of all decent people, like, Google has become like one of the main enemies, I think, a cast of our enemies. You
know? But isn't Google staffed by all these high skilled Indians?
Well, yeah, the Babishes and
Right. In relation to your YouTube channel, Horace, because when you got your channel back, I think Wars messaged me actually, and a few other
people. I did.
Yeah, you did, and Dangerfield as well. They said, "Oh, Horace got his channel back. You should appeal," and I did, and they haven't rejected it. It's still in kind of limbo, I suppose. So they haven't officially rejected
it. Strange.
Yeah, it's. Strange. I'm not expecting to get it back in any respect, but I just think it's interesting. I think the back in the day in 2020, the censorship was so heavy. It's not really like that anymore.
I mean, it was more aggressive then.
Because
been told to calm down a bit, maybe or something.
Yeah, I think that they know the way the wind is blowing in certain scenarios, and I think it's not as bad as it used to be. And COVID at the time was, of course, misinformation, all that shit. They wanted to crack down on. They use that as an excuse lots of times. But yeah, I've appealed, and they haven't rejected it. I'm just waiting. We'll see. But I'm not expecting anything.
In an ideal world, right, Trump gets in. He is what everyone wishes he was, which he's not, obviously. And Musk was, you know, like his guy. And Musk, obviously, would have a reason to want to take down Google. And you'd see Trump maybe doing some sort of antitrust thing. But that's not going to happen, you know. No. If only, right? I mean, he has the power to break them up, you know, break their stranglehold, but he won't.
Well, there was this speech that I've mentioned it quite a few times. It got publicized. It got spread around. Look at 2 months ago or a month ago or something. But and so everyone thought that it was new. Trump had just given this speech. It turns out it was actually from 2 years ago. But anyway, he was pledging very explicitly. I mean, he was sort of laying down what he is going to do once he's back in the White House. So I don't know how he's going to... Well, I guess he could still just go back on it all. But it's strange that he would sort of be so specific about what he was going to do. And what he said was he was going to make it illegal to ban or shadow ban or de-boost anyone for political reasons on all the social media platforms. Like, if you're operating in America, you cannot do this.
It was really remarkable. He set out, I can't remember if it was 10 or 12 points. And as you say, it's actually a couple of years ago, but he got loads more traction a couple of months out from the election. And he was saying, if he does those things, it was pretty mad stuff. I mean, brilliantly mad stuff. You know, I'm sort of jokingly tongue-in-cheek pro-Trump. But, you know, if it's a binary choice, I'm going to pick Trump over someone like Kamala. But I'm still not holding out too many hopes. However, if he does even two or three or four of the things on this list, it's mad. It's like he's just going to stop term limits for ridiculously long-serving, really old congressmen and senators. He's going to like break up the intelligence services sort of thing, make sure they can never, including the FBI, can never get involved in fiddling around with the election ever again. Massive sort of history turning, history defining pledges, giant things. And one of them was like basically tackling Silicon Valley, stopping what happened in 2020 from ever happening again. I mean, as I say, if he does even two or three of these points, it would be remarkable.
He has every interest in doing that last one as well, because it's that sense targeted against his guys, right? But yeah, he still won't. I still don't believe he'll do any of it.
You don't think so?
I'm very, very Trump skeptic. I think of him like a wrestling character. I think, like they were saying this on the podcast, like he's even hired Linda McMahon. Linda McMahon has some sort of role. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, no, she's going to be, Linda McMahon is going to be the Secretary for Education in the United States.
Great.
Low key, I'm a big secret wrestling fan. I'm not going to lie. I do enjoy it. Vince McMahon is one of the most interesting people that's ever lived. I die on that hill. He's incredible. Despite the
is Linda his stuff. Wife?
Linda's his estranged wife, yes.
Right, right, okay. I don't know anything about this.
Well, they're bloody rich, and obviously WWE is, you know, showmanship above all else, right? It's like fake sport, obviously. Sort of like how Trump conducts politics. You know, we're going to build a massive wall. No, actually, what we're going to do is we're going to get struck down by some circuit judge and just drop the idea. That's what you're going to do this time. Like, I think he's just going to do the same.
Oh, God.
He's full of shit. Mass deportations now, there won't be any. There won't be any. He'll deport a few criminals. And the thing he always does, he just does something tiny and calls it a massive win, right? He saves one factory from moving abroad. He says he's turned around. the economy, right? The stock market goes up 100 points and he says it's down to him. It's all he's going to do. Like, he's full of shit. And Musk is probably speaking for him the last few days, more or less.
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? Because obviously Musk has fucked his... I mean, to the extent that it matters, he's fucked his reputation with a lot of people. Not just us, not just our guys, but the wider right in America. Because loads of them just do not want mass immigration, even of high IQ. I mean, they're not falling for that whole thing anymore about it's good for the economy. They don't care. And this is an interesting change that's happened. And I think that Musk didn't realize. I think he thought that he would be like the darling. Everyone would congratulate him for this. And instead, he's got a lot of pushback for it. And it's interesting how badly he's reacted to that. Really like a stroppy child. After I finished the USA banquet, there's people in that were saying Musk was trying to row it back. Because no doubt that was those were the signs just before we did that hangout. But then after that hangout, I went over to Twitter and he wasn't trying to row it back anymore. He was saying he was going to go to war in a way that you can't even possibly imagine over H-1Bs. Because he wants those Pidgeys and he wants them in very large numbers. And if he's not allowed them, then he's going to go to war. I mean, Jesus Christ.
It's a terrible argument, isn't it? I mean, it's a ridiculous argument. First of all, just on the surface of it, that we know that, like, Indian people aren't necessarily of a massively higher IQ. But regardless of that, that's sort of the least strong argument. America, for decades and decades and decades, has led the world in things like research and development and engineering and all sorts of things. Pulled off some of the greatest engineering feat and pushing the human project forward in various respects. They didn't need endless Parjeets to do that. They've got a population of, what, 330, 350 million people or whatever? No, they've got plenty enough geniuses and extremely brilliant and bright engineers or whatever they need. They've got plenty of them. They absolutely don't need a single person from the subcontinent. And everyone knows that, let's be honest. Everyone knows that. So on this one, Elon can get fucked, basically.
And the thing is, it's very clear, because there have been lots of anecdotes about this being posted on Twitter. It's very clear that the native white people, in the Americans, have been, especially like the men, have been held down. They've been sidelined, they've been ignored from, getting jobs, not getting placements, internships and whatever at every stage. Because increasingly, and what we've known this for a long time, it's the hiring people, the HR managers and whatever, are women, and they're highly politicized women who, some of them will have a sort of Nurse Ratched resentment against men. Some of them will be heavily ideological. And they've got multiple reasons not to hire men, especially white men. So they're not hiring white men. So white men who could have had a career, and actually John Carter, who was on Millennial this year, was a science researcher. He was an academic, and he on Twitter he posted his job history, his travails in all of this, and it's very clear just from his example alone that he could have been a successful academic. He could have been contributing productively to the body of scientific knowledge, but instead that basically the system rejected him, and for no reason other than that he's a white man.
I mean,
he's a fucking white male. So
is that a bit of AIDS Skrillex there?
You're a fucking white man. Yeah, quoting. Yeah.
even if it's true that there's a dearth of skills and that's a reason to bring people in, that's a reason to bring people in on temporary visas that expire after 5 years and have an aggressive promotion of, upskilling people at home, right? It's not an excuse to, like, bring in hundreds of thousands of people or millions of people or whatever it is. I was going to relate this to Britain as well. I noticed Farage has chosen today to praise Musk and to say that he's going to make, his support is going to make reform capable of beating the Tories and look cool to the youngsters, right?
Isn't it?
So he's getting more out of touch all the time.
It's like you want him to just shut the fuck up. Stop putting your foot in it? Will you stop making the situation worse, you fucking stupid old boomer? Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say that. He's a boomer. He's a stupid boomer. Yeah.
Like, all that winning means to these people is just, I don't know, just certain stats, just certain statistics about the economy. That's it. Like, they have no concept, like Farage included, they have no concept of the nation. I don't think he ever did. You know, I wonder if it's like just Farage, if he's just got a long family tradition of being like merchant bankers or merchants of some kind. You know, he's like Huguenot background. I don't know if there's like, it's a cultural thing for him. I sort of see Farage as not really a British figure now as well, right? Like, when I think back to everything he said about the EU, it was always just about it's managerial arguments, right? And like, you know, GDP arguments. Like, he never really has shown any passion for the nation, for the people, for Shakespeare, for anything. Like, you know, it's just a managerial stance. It's just I differ from the Tories on whether and how regulated our big businesses should be. That's it.
You know? I think with Farage, it's there's always been this this myth, or he's secretly based. He just won't say it in public, right?
It's the opposite.
Oh, he's secretly based, right?
He keeps letting on how secretly unbased he is.
When does this end? I think what you can say about him, at least, is I said this on a stream earlier in the week. He can be pressured into taking up positions that he probably wouldn't have done before. You know, remember before the election in this country this summer, he was going to go off to America and have a big old media career and make millions of dollars. And then his base said, you know, you're a fucking coward. What is this? Right. What are you doing? And he had to come back and take over reform and run in the election. And now he is where he is. I think he is able to be manipulated in certain respects. But you're right. It's like the slowest kid in the class. You're thinking, oh my God, do I really have to do this every single time? And yes, you do. And you see this with Musk now. I saw Musk, he said, you know, we named our car company Tesla because Nikola Tesla was an immigrant who came and he did all that. It's like, there's a difference between a genius like Nikola Tesla from Europe, a white guy, and Pajit from Mumbai, who wants to clean your floors and deliver your just deeds. It's so fucking retarded. Right,
I particularly hate that argument that just wait until Nigel gets into power and he'll suddenly reveal himself to be uber-based, more based than you could ever imagine. Yeah. It's like, it's just not, there's no reason to think that. There's nothing to point to to suggest that that is the case.
What are they referring to?
Yeah, and it's quite often way. People used to say, Gordon Brown is actually really personable and likable behind closed doors.
What?
Yeah. George Bush Jr. is actually really articulate and clever behind closed doors. Yeah. Joe Biden's actually really quick-witted and sharp as a tack behind closed doors. No. Like, Nigel's really based behind closed doors. No, not. No, what you see is what you get nearly always.
Yeah.
I just don't buy that you just wait. It's the plan. Trust the plan.
I'd love it if maybe like 20 years from now, there'd be a bit of software where you can see every time someone issues these sort of exculpatory canards for like people like Farage. I mean, maybe it won't be him in 20 years' time. But like, where do these come from? Are they just issued from the party? Because I remember the day that Yazir Yusuf became chairman and it was the first mention of him I'd ever heard of earlier this year, right, when he became the chairman of Reform and brought in that money. There was what appeared to me cadres of hundreds of reform activists just issuing the message all over social media. I saw it on Facebook as well, that this is really exciting moment, that this guy's brilliant, that he embodies like what reform's all about. And it was like, you know, organized cadres of message putter outers, you know. Yeah. And I bet the same thing happens in Farage's defense, because he's shallow, but he also knows that most of his supporters are far to the right of him and that he's dragging them to the left, right? So he's quite, I mean, tight as well. You know, these people, they know that they're Tories at heart, and they know that they're like dragging along people who are much more sort of blood and soil, really, like at least implicitly. So they would have, you know, people like that Nicholas Lissack guy. You know, he's been created. That guy's like, his reputation's been created, so as to just excuse the left of reform, basically, in the face of the membership.
It's funny how that happens, isn't it? I remember when trigonometry started. Yeah. And everyone was just baffled.
Like, why have they got any viewers? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Where's the talent? Where's the charisma? Where's the substance? The one of them seems just slimy and disingenuous, and the other one might as well be asleep all the time.
How dare you insult Francis Forster and his immeasurable contributions to that podcast, Wolf?
Sorry, but
in my last Substack essay was about their interview with Niall Ferguson, or Neil Ferguson, from a few months ago, just after the Daryl Cooper interview with Tucker Carlson. And I just referred to it as Constantine Kissin's interview with Ferguson. And I just referred to Foster as Kissin's assistant.
I mean, it's a non-entity in a way that you can't quite believe. Academic Agent did a... it was very funny. He did a video about Francis Foster quite recently, about a month ago. And he outlined that... First of all, he's got his own YouTube channel, and I hate to say this because this is really kicking a guy when he's down. But
he's not down. He's making loads of money. He's all right.
Yeah, that's true. He's making far more than we are. So
yeah, fuck him.
He's got his own YouTube channel, and it's only got about 5,000 subscribers when he's got like hundreds of thousands on trigonometry.
Over a million. Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yep.
So. Yeah, so but somehow his own channel is just, and then you look at it, you watch the stuff, and you realize, okay, this is why he's only got 5K, because his stuff is dreadful. And I have actually, I've seen him live as a stand-up comedian, and again, it's just dreadful.
What, so, you were actually in the room, Colin, when he was doing
it? I think, yes, I'm afraid I was. There was a comedy club in London. I've actually seen Constantine Kissin. He and I made eye contact outside this club, and I think it was funny because I'm pretty sure he knew who I was.
Really?
When you say eye contact, was it like, you know, like strangers in the night?
Oh God, no!
Exchanging glances. No,
I think each of us was thinking, "Oh fuck, it's him," kind of thing. It was very no. There was certainly no.
Frisson of romance, right?
Oh no, no, not at all.
Was he any good at comedy?
No.
But Francis Foster, especially, it was just bad.
He's just so exactly lifeless. As
you expect, you know. And I feel again, I don't like this because to me, he's a sort of what's the term like an unwitting accessory. He doesn't really understand what's going on around him. The villain in the piece is obviously Constantine Kissin. And he's got Francis Foster as, I don't know, like a ventriloquist dummy or something like that. That's the extent of his agency in all of this. So the villain is Constantine Kissin.
It definitely feels like they're astroturf. So I remember them coming sort of out of nowhere. And
totally, yeah.
And like they've been on Joe Rogan a couple of times, like whether they've got an agent, a proper agent or whatever. God knows what. I don't care. But... I actually made another good point not too long ago about content creators that have got like a real following with actual fans, and you'll go to different platforms and do different things and people will follow you wherever you go. And then people that have got giant audiences, but it's not a real following. And he said like trigonometry, yeah, they've got massive numbers, but if trigonometry just didn't exist tomorrow, no one would really care.
Right? No, I mean, their interview style is dreadful. They don't even have the sense to look like they're interested. If you watch their body language when the other person, when their guest is talking, they just look like, I don't know, like a pair of half interested job interviewers, like burnt out. They're thinking about the next cup of coffee, you know, that sort of thing.
I would mention an exception in that Niall Ferguson interview. It sounds crazy to say this, but I have to give Kissin a little bit of credit. He did try to steel man a little bit the nationalist case. He did put to him several times, like, and Ferguson wasn't really answering directly, but Kissin put it to him two or three times, like the native people of Britain and other white countries. He didn't put it exactly these words, but the native people of Britain and other white countries are being reduced to a minority. Like, yeah. Are you specifically saying that's okay, Neil? And he was like, basically, yeah, and very insistently, in fact. But he did, like, Kissin was the one trying to put our case a little bit. He mangled it, but, you know. And that's how anti-white Niall Ferguson is. But of course, he's still a friend of their show and everything he was saying. I mean,
That's a containment gambit 101, isn't it? Go a little bit onto the raggedy edges of the Overton window. you know, just skirt onto the seal of the Overton window and no further. I mean, that's classic containment, isn't it?
It amounts to that, yeah. I mean, Kissing did, I give him credit for putting the questions to him, but he didn't push back at all. And it was just fuel for Ferguson to just expatiate more on his vision of a totally Africanized world. And it is as bad as I described, by the way, if anyone hasn't watched it.
Yeah, the thing with Kissing is, I mean, if I wasn't aware of trigonometry and Kissing and all the shit from gone years back, he still owes me £5, by the way.
Yeah.
But if you see him on Good Morning Britain one day, just as a normie, and he's fighting back against the net zero shit, you think, wow, this guy's got his head screwed on. This guy's talking the absolute truth. And he does on that issue. I don't disagree with any of it. He's very good at articulating himself. However, they are completely astroturfed, these guys. And these guys, Kissing, not the other one. Fuck him. He's a lapdog. Kissing is completely astroturfed. And his role is, like you said, containment, essentially. He goes as far as he can, and then he draws back, because the last thing that we can have is white European collectivism. That's
it. He said himself.
You cannot do that. That, yeah, of course. Can you remember when he interviewed that fucking Rotherham?
Black Lives Matter thing as well. And this is the reason that we've opposed identity politics from the start, because once you start going down this rabbit hole of going, this is a special group, and this is a special group, and that's a special group, and that's a special... But these people, they're not special at all. In fact, they need... Then you get into trouble, because eventually, you know, Helen Dale, who we had on the show, you know, she said, I remember saying this in the 90s, you know, if you're going to have gay pride, at some point, someone's going to go, we need straight pride.
Straight pride, yeah.
And this is the problem with all of this. Yeah. And this is the far left that you talk about. That's where it all comes from, this ideology of getting everybody into their own little group, and now white people need to advocate for themselves. That's not, you know, you talk about history, not a healthy recipe.
No,
not a healthy recipe. We need to go back to this idea that people are individuals, you know, and you can be racist against anyone, including white.
Sorry,
should be racist against anyone.
No, there you go. That's exactly what I was talking about. But, a point made, I guess. There you go.
Yeah, it talks about how that's a problem. Yeah, problem for who?
For him.
The thing is, if a country doesn't serve its native people, then what is the point of that country? What's winning. The point of that society?
Winning. We're a team. We're winning.
Indeed. This is the mentality that they're pushing here. Well, Musk is certainly pushing that a nation is just a sports team. But then that means, what about the people who can't compete? What about the dead wood? The old people, the whatever.
They totally can compete as well, so, yeah.
I mean, it's just a terrible attitude. But Kissing, you know, it all just comes back to the fact that he's not British. Mm. And, you know, it's silly. And it's demonstrably, you can see what he's saying. You can see the thing he is, the ideology he's pushing, the worldview that he's pushing, is one that is detrimental to our existence, literally.
The whole anti-woke field is just pure enemy to all of us, I think. It's like there's nothing to be salvaged from that. The pure anti-woke is just containment, right? It's leftists, centre-leftists, telling the further left, you are making us look bad, that is helping our enemies, our common enemies, i.e. the real right. Anyone who joins in on anti-woke stuff, I just think, becomes an enemy. Spiked is the epitome of it, right? Not just for that article the other day. I mean, they've been doing it for years, but especially that one the other day. But yeah, Spiked and trigonometry epitomize, and like Andrew Doyle, I think, and GB News as well, they epitomize the anti-woke thing, which is just pure enemy. It has to be defeated and destroyed.
Again, it's interesting because there's this comedy club in London that I went to a few times. And that was the one that I mentioned, where I saw Constantine Kissing and Francis Foster. And Andrew Doyle is there. That whole crowd are there.
Is this the anti-politically correct comedy club that they've all set up? Yeah. Well, what's that called? It's like a thing.
I can't actually remember off the top of my head. It's like the comedy... I can't remember. But... I'll actually have to Google it and tell you. That it's at Bethnal Green in London.
You don't have to. I'm never going to go.
It's like backdoor comedy. The Backyard Comedy Club. And the night itself is called... hold on a minute.
Yeah, I think I've been there. I think it's Lee
Comedy
Hurst.
Unleashed. Thing, yeah. Comedy Unleashed.
Yeah, Lee Hurst's place, right?
Yeah. And, you know, some of it's funny. There are some stand-up comedians there that are genuinely funny. But I've got to say, what's interesting about this, from the point of view of us, is how fossilized it already is. I went last year, and they were telling the same jokes that they were telling in 2019 about, you know...
this famous person doesn't know what a woman is.
yeah, exactly. It's immediately become fossilized in that moment, like really pre-COVID, actually, because that was their... this is the gender criticals. Again, I wrote an essay last year about this crowd for this reason, because I think it's interesting. It's an example of a bunch of lefties who have fallen out with the rest of the left. They've fallen out with the broad thrust of the left. But that doesn't mean they're not lefties anymore. And the thing is that they see themselves as rebels, because for the first time in their life, they actually are rebelling against something. But they're only rebelling on one particular issue. On everything else, on feminism, diversity, mass immigration, gay rights, whatever, on everything else, they're still avowedly left-wing. Like J.K. Rowling, you know, she's still a feminist. She's still, you know, all the rest of it. The trans issue is unique and uniquely incendiary, because it's pissed a lot of lefties off. They can't go along with it. But that doesn't mean that they're not lefties anymore. And what's interesting, as I say, is they see themselves as rebels, but then they're desperate for the... I mean, they're not like us. They're not sort of burnt out. They're not accustomed to being out of the mainstream. These are people who have been suddenly denied the red carpet and the book deals and everything. So it really is a horrible, for them, it's a very, very uncomfortable position to be in. J.K. Rowling is unique because she was so wealthy and prominent and powerful that she could withstand it. Most of them, it really is a big deal, because it's the end of their career.
J.K. Rowling is, you're right, she's an anomaly, because she was already super successful and super rich, and I don't look at her and think, oh, I hate her, she's a feminist. I think, no, she is what she is, and she's having a very genuine stance against this thing that she finds ridiculous. And I can respect that. We probably wouldn't agree on 99% of things, but I can respect her position on that particular topic. These Comedy Unleashed people, they're just fucking losers. I mean, let's be honest. They would never have achieved anything in life. And they're not comedians, come on. They would never achieve anything like if this woke thing wasn't a thing, because their entire brand is being anti this.
I mean, there's not comedians.
They're not comedians.
The Jewish Comedian of the Year 2018.
Oh, well, excuse me. I mean, you've corrected me. I'm so sorry. I apologize.
How the fuck?
See,
that was before he was unleashed.
That's a small point there that should be addressed. That it's obviously absurd for Constantine Kesson to win a Comedian of the Year award, unless it's the crap Comedian of the Year. Like, who was the crappest comedian this year? Short of Francis Foster. Who was the second crap? It's obviously going to be Constantine Kesson. He's
not Francis Foster every year.
He's not funny. So that was obviously just bloody nepotism. Of course.
James Corden had the crap Comedian of the Year locked down until Francis Foster came along.
But then he'll say, of course, nepotism is the worst thing in the world, and white people should never do that. But Dan, that point you made is very interesting. That this whole crowd, and you know, I don't hate them. It's more than I pity them,
because
I think they don't. A lot of them are just don't actually understand the situation at all. They don't have the brain power or the rebellious spirit to really see what's going on here. So they think it's all about wokery, and that wokery just emerged from nowhere in like 2013, and before that everything was fine, and it's inexplicable. The world just went mad. It's the woke mind virus.
Oh God. Well, here's the thing, right? So Kissin and the rest of his crowd, I think broadly I agree with you, but I do think there are some kingpins in that scene, like Kissin, for example,
who
are very intellectual and know exactly what they're doing. However, I think broadly speaking, none of these people are saying anything that Milo Yiannopoulos didn't say in 2015. You know, and Milo did it better. I'm sorry to say that he did it way better. But back then it wasn't cool. It was a bit on the fringe. Now these people are astroturfed. Fucking hell. I mean, the rise of trigonometry is completely unnatural. Their entire concept of that channel is we're going to have uncomfortable conversations that you will never see anywhere else. They've never had one controversial conversation ever. they've never been cancelled. None of their guests have ever been cancelled from anything ever. Get fucking Nick Fuentes on. Do that. They won't. Not even you, Colin. Not even me. Not even, nobody.
No. I mean, some of them. To be fair, they've been. What's happened is they have been. Like, you'll get some comedian who has been cancelled in the sense that she had a gig going on, and she made a joke that was about trans. And that gig has been cancelled. She is no longer able to get gigs in the comedy scene because the comedy scene is unbelievably progressive. It's it's a police state. So it's very easy to fall foul of their standards because their standards are stringent as hell. So that's what people have been cancelled from. But then there's this whole, as you say, there's this mini industry sort of paralleling the comedy industry, which is the anti-woke thing. And, you know, it's not, it's definitely a lot smaller. I mean, the money is nowhere near what it would have been for these people. But my point is that exists solely as a counterweight to the woke craze. You've got the anti-woke craze. And its purpose is to keep people on the plantation or just... I don't know, because a lot of them, as I say, they're just not bright enough. They don't need to keep them on the plantation because they would never work things out anyway.
I do think that when it comes to trigonometry specifically, I watched something they did recently with one of the Weinstein brothers. There's what are they called? It's Eric and someone else. I think it was Eric.
Brett,
they did
an interview with Brett and Eric. I think you were
Brett and Eric. Yes. Brett was the one that was calling bullshit on the whole COVID thing back in the day, right? So they did an interview with Eric, and the entire interview is like an hour and 20 minutes. The entire interview was just like, what do you think about this? Well, I don't know. It could be anything. It was an hour and 10 minutes of just, I don't know anything. It could be this, it could be that. Anything can happen. And it was just this intellectual fucking wankery. And that's the entire thing. It's like, is this supposed to be? What is this telling me? What am I supposed to take from this? The entire thing is so astroturf, man. It's crazy.
I think that Eric is like Brett is the better one of those two. It's like the Hitchens brothers, you know. They're both kind of bad, but one of them is a lot worse than the other.
I just wanted to relate this back to something. Like, it's good that you're mentioning like not only the sort of anti-woke thing of the last few years in Britain, but it is kind of an international thing, isn't it, as well? Because like you mentioned what stuff that Milo was saying like about 9 or 10 years ago. Obviously, that was shortly after Gamergate. There was just, like Dave Rubin's show sort of started about 10 years ago, and that was
I forgot about Dave positive, Rubin.
Jesus. Like, positive, like challenging conversations and all this shit. Milo was on it. Obviously, Milo was saying some of this stuff on Dave Rubin's show, but. Also, like one of my favourite Wosey moments ever was 2019, I think summer 2019, and Hugh on the Offensive was over in Britain, and you did a little, just a sort of light-hearted podcast with him, Wose.
Oh, yeah.
And you were just, and it was, yeah, and it was just about the time when the IDW, like the intellectual dark web, it wasn't even particularly what you were saying, it's just the hilarity that you guys found in like the way they pose themselves, you know. I think they were like hiding in bush, like poking out of bushes and stuff in their photos. And stuff.
Yeah, Yeah, it was a photo shoot that they'd obviously spent quite a lot of money on. And it was supposed to make them look, I don't know, mysterious, dangerous, or, you know, exotic.
Dangerous.
It just looked like a bunch of perverts in a garden yeah. site.
Unleashed. Fucking but the, I mean, from the first moment, the IDW was a brand launched by Barry Weiss, who's not, like, she's neither woke, anti-woke or nothing. She's just, she's just, like, at the heart of basically the international, you know. And, like, she's, like, an arch-Zionist, right? And a leftist and a lesbian and everything, right? And, like, she was at the heart. I mean, she created that term. Barry Weiss. I mean, like, what if you if that's what anti-woke is centered around, it's not even what it pretends to be.
I mean, all that stuff is containment, isn't it? I mean, even Peterson, but like both of those Weinstein brothers at various times I've seen them say exactly what Kissing said in that clip, basically that white collectivism must be prevented at all costs. I've seen both of them say that.
Eric Weinstein was saying that just a few days ago, yeah.
Yeah. I've seen Brett Weinstein say it as well, and like flipping off the Arch of Titus or the Arch of Constantine or whatever it was, because they committed Jewish massacres in ancient times
against the massive armed rebellion by the Jews.
I mean, it's just it's.
But
it's,
again, it's okay, so that can only possibly matter to him if he has collectivism, if his group matters across thousands of years, then, well, okay, fine. Then why shouldn't our group matter to us across thousands of years? Why is he saying that would be terrible? I mean, again, I understand it. It's just like the hypocrisy is just so obvious. Sorry, Horace.
Has he even tried tidying his room yet anyway? I mean, you've got to do that first before you know where you stand. Like, I mean,
oh, that's Jordan.
These silly ideas come from like male degeneracy or whatever, don't they? And you know, not getting yourself in order.
So. Well, this is the tedious thing about Jordan Peterson. Some of his advice is perfectly good, tidying your room. It's a good idea if your life is a mess. A good first step is to tidy your room. Get your immediate surroundings under control. It's a good, but. That doesn't change. Like he'll say that, like he'll say, okay, you're claiming that your world is corrupt and bent against you, and your people are under threat. Why don't you just tidy your room? Well, that's a fucking stupid thing to say. And he
Jordan Peterson is quite a lol cow for me. When he tweeted about Jude and Peterstein, like him saying it, that made me laugh. So much. I was laughing for ages. What a funny character he turned into.
But there have been some incidents. I think he's calmed down over the last year. But like this time last year, he was going nuts on Twitter. I mean, it was so. Again, it made me feel a bit guilty because the guy's clearly mentally ill. But he should just fucking log out of Twitter. Just stop it.
Loads of these people have got loads of really good things to say. Like, I remember the first time I saw Jordan Peterson, the very first time, I think, ever, it was just some clip. And it was like a really heartfelt, touching clip, something about the human condition. And he was completely right. You know, like, even someone like Alex Jones, a big chunk of what Alex Jones says is fine and correct and a good take. Someone like some cretin like Ben Shapiro, big chunks of what he says are just accurate political analysis, right?
Christopher Hitchens, I've agreed with many times.
Yeah, right, exactly. I've agreed and disagreed with both Christopher and Peter Hitchens about loads of things. So anyway, you can get someone that they say loads of good stuff. Like Iconoclast was saying, like, if you catch Constantine Kissing talking about the green hoax or something, it's all spot on. You can't really fault it. But, you know, you just got to be careful what these people are at their base, at their foundation, what all the other edifices are built upon. What is their fundamental worldview on certain big, big things? And, then you have to start thinking about a friend-enemy distinction at some point, don't you?
Exactly.
Even if you do agree with a big chunk of what they say.
And they sure think about it.
I think with Jordan Peterson, quite uniquely, there's a struggle, and it's an internal struggle because he wants to be truthful. I don't think he's a born shithead. Right? I think he does actually have a lust for the truth and a desire, veneration for the truth. But he's in a position where he has to tell himself a load of bullshit and he has to spout a load of bullshit. So then that leads to, well, you know, mental illness and whatever. And you end up with this kind of thing where, and this is obviously fake, but he was demanding that people tell him, like, go by their real names, these anonymous troll demons and so on. And it was just absurd. Because he knows damn well why, and indeed he contradicted, again, this is it, like he made a fool of himself, he contradicted himself, I think from one day to the next, saying it, how great it is that some rebels in some other country could use Twitter anonymously to fight their regime, but then he's also saying that Twitter shouldn't allow anonymous accounts, because that means people can, you know, harass him. You know, I don't think it's good to harass people, but this is, everyone knows why anonymity is useful. The reason he doesn't need anonymity is that he doesn't actually say anything that really is controversial.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head there, but, and you can put this on Constantin Kissin as well. I think I was speaking to Chris Dangerfield and he was telling me about an article he read about Constantin Kissin. And apparently the article ended with, you know, he's a man with nothing to say. And I thought, yeah, it's pretty accurate, actually. And with Peterson, I've said this before, and I posted a tweet or an X, whatever the fuck you call it now. I posted something recently about Peterson, and I said, he's giving all of this masculine advice to men about how you should live your life and do all this. And I can't take it seriously because any regular bloke from my hometown could kick his fucking head in anytime they want, you know? It is true. It's a visceral reaction, and it's not nothing. It matters. If you're gonna lecture men and tell them how they should live their lives, then you have to have something about you, physicality wise, because otherwise you're talking shit. Might is right in many ways, and I'm not saying that he's got nothing to offer. I think a lot of people back in the day when he came on the scene, because men were lost in general, especially Western men. And they found him and they found something to hold on to, whatever his message was back then. But Jordan Peterson today from back then is a completely different person, I think. And he is, I mean, he's employed by the fucking Daily Wire, isn't he? So that's one thing. There are things that he can't touch on, things he can't say. But just the general physicality of the man, and people are, well, Douglas Murray's gay, so he gets a pass, I suppose. But, you know, Jordan Peterson, he is a bit of a weakling. And if you're going to tell men how they can improve their lives, I think you need to sort that out, really. And I knew the writing was on the wall for Jordan Peterson when he started wearing that blazer that was, have you seen that blazer? It was like half of it was one color and another half was another color.
I think he actually has multiple blazers like that. And
yes, and I just thought, why are you doing? You're not a superstar, bro. You're supposed to be an intellectual. What are you doing? This is like Lady Gaga. What are you doing right now? What is going on here?
It was just crazy. It was like an eccentric or insane professor who's suddenly got a lot of money.
He believed in his own hype. That's what he believed in his own hype, and someone convinced him, "Oh, you can be a celebrity as well." And that's not. You don't want that.
Yeah.
I just had a lot of money, doesn't he?
Well, he certainly does. I mean, he's employed by the Daily Wire at this point, but I think even before that, he must have been fucking rolling.
Before that, he was already making tens of thousands of dollars per month on Patreon, plus his books, plus lectures, plus his salary, I think, plus YouTube revenue as well. So, yeah, he was fuckless.
That's astonishing. I mean, yeah, and I don't want to seem petty. I wish we were all making that kind of money. Yeah, I wish we please. Were. It's annoying when it goes to men who are, well, corrupted and dishonest. And I'm afraid that Jordan Peterson, I do think he started out with good intentions. I mean, I don't think he was I don't think he was in the 90s rubbing his hands together thinking, how can I trick the masses and become evil and all this? I think he started out well enough, but The issue really is kind of similar to a lot of the gender criticals that I talked about earlier, that he doesn't have the strength of character to rebel against the orthodoxy of his time. He thinks he does. He wants to, because he wants the cachet and he wants the self-respect of knowing that he stood for truth and, you know, all that. But he doesn't. And so he ends up going this very half-assed route where he'll rebel on the trans issue, but on nothing else.
It all ends in the same place. All of these people that we're talking about, trigonometry, Peterson, Shapiro, you know, all these types of people, the anti-woke mob, right? Yes, of course. It all ends at one point, and that is we can't allow European collectivism. We can't do it. We cannot allow that to happen. We can't even suggest that it's a good thing. We have to shut that down immediately. That's the way it is. That's their line in the sand. That's what all of these people are there to do. They're stopping us from going there, trying their best. But I do think that the Elon Musk thing in the last few days has been quite funny. But I do think that they are lashing out big time, because I think that's where the wind is blowing. And I don't know if they're going to be able to contain it for much longer. I really don't.
There's been a few people, like Endeavor was one, and some other guys saying, yeah, like, don't be blackpilled about what's happened the last few days. I mean, it's obviously some people are disappointed because they thought better of Musk. I think quite a lot of us already knew what he was like.
I
mean,
I think most of us looked at him with a sideways glance and we thought, yeah, okay, you're doing some good stuff. I'm not sure about the chips in the brain, but okay, let's see what you do. But yeah, I agree. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, well, the reason for not being blackpilled is because this is at least making our enemies, well, they're having to have arguments that they never had to have before. That's one thing. And they are, I mean, I assume Musk thought, yeah, like what I think you said earlier, Iconoclast, that, yeah, Musk probably thought that what he was saying was going to be popular, but it's just kind of like a turd in a drink. You know, I even saw Jack Posobiec having a go at him. Charlie Kirk was still on the plantation, I noticed. But it was like a large part of the world. I think like Lady MAGA was like on our side, and like there was other people. There was that Cat Turd account, which I thought was like a horrible centre left thing. They were agreeing with us.
Laura Loomer was like, on our side.
Laura Loomer's on our side. Yeah, there we go. We haven't managed to recruit the venerable Ian Miles Chong, and I don't think we ever will. But,
For fuck's sake. Sorry.
Ian Miles is chatting to him happily about all this, yeah.
I have to chime in here. Ian Miles Chong, who the fuck is this guy? Why is he everywhere?
Isn't it just like, sort of gross? I mean, I actually was going to make a tweet about this. I made a couple of screenshots earlier. Let me see if I can get them now. But basically,
why does Musk follow the shittiest account? What is that about?
I remember Morgoth described him as like Musk is Indiana Jones and he's Short Round from Temple of Doom.
I think that's an insult to Short Round, to be honest.
Well, here he is. So this is him just now agreeing with Musk that competition is where it's at, and if people want a country of their own, then they want entitlements, right? And here he is a year ago. Immigrants depress wages by competing with native workers. So he knows damn well. And I thought, you know, is this how you become a big content creator? Like, he's got, I don't know, thousands, hundreds of thousands. You just have to have no consistency, no concern for hypocrisy whatsoever. And I don't know, you'll make it big. Because it just seems time and again, the big figures are like this. And I'm sorry to sound jealous. I kind of am jealous in a way. But what the fuck? I mean, they've just got no integrity at all. He's just saying whatever fucking works in the minute.
Well, he'll be making decent money off Twitter now because
he'll
be monetized. So he's probably just going where whatever Elon does, he'll support because he knows where his bread's buttered. That's the way it is.
I saw Ian Miles Chong replying to Steve Laws saying, "Enjoy your replacement."
Yep.
It's absolutely detestable.
Pure enemy. Piece of shit.
I got one
little anecdote about him. He, when Lotus Cities was brand new, he wrote a few articles for us, and a few people in the office just didn't like him and would say to Carl, like, let's not publish him anymore, he's a joke. And in the end, he had this massive falling out with, you know, Jeremy at the Quartering over a pretty serious incident, like what's it called when you call the police? A fake, call in a fake police.
Like swatting.
Spotting. Yeah. Someone's dog got killed or something. Some really horrible thing that Imal Strong did. And anyway, one last thing, just to stick the knife in, if there's any need to dunk on Imal Strong any longer, his writing was absolutely abominable. He basically couldn't write, and our editor would have to sort of rework it into like readable English. It's pathetic. It's pathetically bad.
That's what ChatGPT is there for. You just put it through that.
Piece of shit. Hate that.
Isn't he also informing America what the meaning of America is from Malaysia? Doesn't he live in Malaysia?
God, yeah.
And he's from Malaysia. He's also said things implying that he's a wrong'un as well, which I think.
Well, the fit never very rarely lies, does it?
Right.
And he looks like a wrong'un, so.
See, I was going to ask. Sorry, Bill. I was going to ask because lower seasons have a lot of pull. I was going to ask if you'd ever had him on or would have him on as a guest, but you just explained that.
Yeah, so that's what happened. Cole was just like okay with him until we explained various things. I think actually in the end, because Cole also knows Jeremy from the Quartering, I think at some point Jeremy sent him an email saying something like, why are you publishing Imal Strong? He's a piece of shit. He like got my dog killed or one of my friend's dogs killed or something like that.
Jesus.
And then at that point, like Carl was like, fair enough. And then we haven't published him since. So no, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't have him on. Although you never know, there is an element at Lotus Eaters which actively want to interview lefties, at least every now and again, once in a blue moon, get a lefty on.
I
think that's a good idea. It's good to, to just have a bit of variety. And I mean, I would do it on Millennial, except that I don't think I'd be good at it. I think it's fine.
What do you mean, have Narinda on?
There's good and bad things too. It is good in the sense of showing that you're not afraid to, that the arguments will stand up on their own and all that sort of thing. The downside is that usually your audience just hates it. Like whenever we've had a lefty or even a sort of a semi-centrist lefty type person, our audience, our core audience, just hate it. It's like, you know, when you watch GB News and they've got an actual commie, a full-blown commie on. I always just think, oh, why are you doing this? Why are you subjecting my eyeballs and ears to this? Why are you doing this? Well, at least they can fall back and say, well, Ofcom sort of forces us to on some level, whereas, Lotus Eaters doesn't have to do that, but I'm not against it 100%, but I do usually argue, let's not have Albie on or something like that.
He wouldn't even be interesting or anything. Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Mm. When are Lotus Eaters going to go full on, ethno-nationalists? Come on. It's going to happen.
Well, I mean,
it has to happen. I don't want to put you in a bad spot, but come on.
Well, again, there's certain things that we do have to be a bit careful about. Otherwise, we'll just get completely yeeted, right? And I mean, that is one of them. We have talked to like Dan Tubb, talked to the Homeland guys last year. And I speak to them. Maybe, we skirt the line of it. But there's certain things where if you just come out and just explicitly say certain things, you're just going to get completely yeeted.
I think the criticism are doing good work. I've got to say it.
Thank you very much.
I do too. I'm not trying to like.
No worries.
Shut up. I like it as well.
It's like coming out and saying saying something explicitly pro-Russian, right? Because I'm not pro-Russian, but I am very anti-Zelensky, right?
Sure.
And so you've just got to skate the line. You can't be too. Unfortunately, right? I did a piece just the other day talking about the censorship industrial complex. That the intelligence services, there's this giant infrastructure and giant amounts of money based around sort of global censorship. And again, there's just a certain point where you can't go any further because certain things you'll get prosecuted under hate speech, or you'll just get so many complaints that you'll get yeeted, or you'll get like loads of DDoS attacks or all sorts of shit. There's only so far you can go at the moment. I mean, that is the battle, isn't it, over the Overton window.
I think
we can
all raise like a festive toast to Lotus Eaters. I think I think you guys do good work. Like you do act. I think more than anyone else I can think of, you act as a bridge between, and this is crucial stuff, like crucial work. The bridge between what is, I don't know what you call it, the centre right and the right. the real right, the fake right and the real right. Lotus Eaters acts as a kind of a bridge, like, and not fully. I mean, you know, like, you're more inclined to have a lefty guest on than anyone to the right of Lotus Eaters, perhaps, or much to the right of it. So, you know, there's still, but, you know, you're playing the game like everyone has to, right? But I think Lotus Eaters have done a hell of a good job. And also, several, like, not just about guests, but obviously several of you are based as well. Like, there was a little controversy last year, obviously, wasn't there, over who was the most based Lotus Eater. But, but I think Josh was one of your best guests this year. I think Josh was a great interview as well. Like, so he's a contender for that now as well. But I say Bo, but I'm a bit biased.
Yeah, I said that.
I'd say Bo too, yeah.
Yeah, it's I've had Josh Firm, obviously Bo, Harry Robinson, and there was a fourth one on this year. But
Stelios?
No, not Stelios.
Dan Tubb?
Oh, yes, it's Dan Tubb. That's it. Yes. Oh, yeah. He was good. I really enjoyed that one. It was a very practical millennial, which is what I want to do. Like, I want to do that, more of that in future. But I've got nothing. I mean, I think the Lotus Eaters is good. I think it does good work, and it's, you know, I like the idea of interacting with lefties. As I say, with myself, I mean, millennial isn't the forum for debate. I did do it a couple of times early on, like with Mike Isaacson. But I think
I remember that. That was good. That was hilarious.
Yeah, it was. It was certainly a unique piece of internet history, I think. A very strange interaction. But, and, you know, I don't regret it at all. But I think millennial has become something that's much more easygoing. Like, it shouldn't be combative. And so that's why I wouldn't, well, that's one of the reasons I wouldn't have lefties on. But the other reason is I just feel increasingly that I live in a different universe from them. I'm not good at, you know, we have so many, we have so many suppositions, like things that we just take for granted that they have never even heard of. Mm. Like the idea that a country should belong to a group, to a particular group. That's a new idea for them. They might, various things. Even the idea that men and women are different and complementary, that's obvious to us. We take it for granted. But for a lot of lefties, that's like, it's definitely dangerous and it's definitely questionable. It might, you know, they might assume that's just woo-woo. You know, you've just said that.
I'm of the opinion, and I'm pretty hard line on it, one of the most hard line at Lotus Eaters is, and, you know, I don't by any stretch of the imagination always win. You know, the ultimate authority would always lie with Carl. But my line is that I'm not interested in any sort of dialogue with lefties. Not interested in it. When they want to come over and they start getting interested in us, we'll have a conversation. Until then, I'm not going to lock horns with many lefties ever.
Yeah,
I'm not going to try and convince them. I don't want any sort of conversation with them. But I mean, that's just me.
That's like I do agree with you. It's like I don't honestly, in my heart of hearts, I don't really think that there's anything they can teach us. I don't think there's any wisdom and maybe this is a bad sign. I can imagine someone saying, and this is how Colin became an extremist. This is how he fell down the rabbit hole and he was no longer open to dialogue. Well, I'm sorry, but I hear them, I listen to them, and I just think you people are in the creche. You're in the intellectual creche. You know nothing. So it's very difficult for me to find common ground with them.
Yeah. I don't want to try and convince an Islamist or an arch feminist, or an actual Marxist Leninist. I don't want to have to spend hours trying to convince them that they're wrong, especially when they're, to use a Peterson line, when they're animus possessed, and that they will not listen, they will not take on board realities. I'm not interested in that. I haven't got enough time in my life for that. But
yeah, exactly. Ain't nobody got time for that.
There is a kind of total disparity between the left and the right, isn't there? They're not like equivalent things. Like the right, like on the left, like it feels like whatever the left might have been 50 years ago, they're just a sort of dull remnant, dull sort of automated remnant of that now. Like, what I seldom encounter a leftist who's got anything interesting. So, like what you said, Bo, like, yeah, what is the point in debating with people who they're gonna dig their heels in? It's gonna take hours, and even if you win the argument, they're probably just gonna come back the next day as if it didn't happen, right? That's a classic thing with lefties, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that was even discussed in that book, My Struggle, from the 20s. But yeah, like that is what you encounter, and it's like, well, this is not worth it. This is not, time is limited, right? Ever, you know, my energies are limited. Most lefties are not worth talking to. The odd interesting one, they kind of stand out anyway.
Right.
But yeah, I know what you mean. I used to think debate was everything, but I kind of sharpened my teeth already, you know? And now it's just like, well, now it's just war, you know? Like, these people are trying to destroy us. Fuck them. It's about winning.
Yeah, yeah. I used to have the same attitude. Like, we can learn from each other, like, cross-pollination. It'll be interesting. Like, back in 2018, 19, I still had that attitude. And I think maybe COVID is the big reason why not. It feels like everything became much more immediate after that, you know, because it was such a big deal. But I think also the situation in other ways has just heated up. You know, like after these riots earlier this year, you know, just to bring in a timely England issue to this discussion, I saw the loathing and contempt on the left and the middle class for those rioters, those protesters. There was no effort at all to see their point of view. None. Nobody cared. And so, okay, well, why should we care about seeing their point of view? Especially when we already know their bloody point of view, because we're immersed in it. We live their reality. We live in the society crafted by these leftist ideas. So what are they going to fucking teach us? What are these people going to say that we don't already know and haven't already refuted? It's
like, I mean, I suppose one should wonder, like, who is still a leftist at this point? Who hasn't had the illusion stripped away at this point? Who is still so conformist to the state? I mean, that's how I think of leftists now. They're just
the staff of the BBC. Maybe that's it.
Talking of the BBC, like, people might want to look at two essays on my Substack about the BBC. The Chaos of the Ether is the first one. Anyway, sorry.
There's also a great article on lotusseeds.com by me about having to confront Auntie. We need to talk about Auntie, where I caned the BBC pretty hard. But yeah, take for example that Muslim MP who is arguing for first cousin marriage, right? I've got no intention of...
I love the idea that he had to bring that in subtly. Like,
of engaging.
Okay, hear me out.
Like that, right? Yeah, yeah. Let's see where he's going with this. No, I've got no intention of trying to change someone like that's mind.
Yeah, right.
They need to be gone, and their way of thinking is incorrect. Right, that's very authoritarian. Oh, you know. Well, so be it. Okay, yeah. Oh, that's so reactionary. Yeah, yeah. I'm proud of that. Then, yeah. First cousin marriage is disgusting, and so on and so on. Like, if you've got someone who's coming over from the left, or someone that was quite left, but you're starting to see the error of their ways, I think of someone like perhaps Dave Rubin or that Anna Kasparian, noticing that there are in fact problems with the Democrat Party. Even if there's a small chink in their armour, then okay, have a conversation. But whilst they're completely still in it,
what's the point?
It's not for me. It's not for me. It never gets anywhere. Like trying to debate someone like that, that Walsh or Destiny or someone. Oh. No. Gosh. No, I'm not interested in doing that, and I'm not interested in watching other people trying to do it either. It's
exactly. That's how I feel as well. How could I possibly have a conversation with Walsh? You know, what would I? What common ground could there possibly be? I mean, it just feels futile.
There's nothing. Futile. Well, whenever, see, you know, Piers Morgan has his uncensored channel on YouTube, right? And he has Destiny on every now and then. And I'm thinking, why? And it's just because he wants the clicks from Destiny's subscribers. Yeah. That's why. But why would you have this fucking retard on? Seriously, it's so ridiculous. And yeah, it's like it's the entire debate sphere is a joke. It doesn't matter. It's all fake. Nobody cares.
You really do see very little debate across the divide, don't you? You still, even now, it's almost all righties talking to righties or just lefties talking to lefties. There's very little sincere sort of civil disagreement anywhere. Like, even on those things like Intelligence Squared or, I don't know.
Well, I think that's because the stakes are just so high. I mean, if for one of us, if we were to concede ground to a lefty, that would be... I think we all feel that we were letting the side down, but also these are ideas that we've all thought about already. You know, that we, as I said earlier, we live in their society. So what would it be that we were conceding to? But from their point of view, if they concede anything to us, then they could end up like at the gender criticals where they get fucked for the first time in their lives. They're out in the cold. And that's terrifying. But the other thing is, they just wouldn't anyway, because if they're gonna do it, and some of them are going to do it, then they'll just do it. Like that woman who I had on this year, Nina Power. I think it's in her nature to seek the truth, and that's why in the end it was inevitable that she was going to come into conflict with a lot of people that she was otherwise friendly with. But a lot of them are just never going to do this because they fundamentally don't have that desire for the truth. They're just fucking around, really.
That was a really good interview with her. The first time I heard of Nina Power, for some reason I was watching the Marxism event. You know, like there's just a festival called Marxism each year in London. And she was speaking at that next to Terry Eagleton, and that was 10 years ago. And I would never, ever have thought. I mean, I'd heard of you back then. I was one of the first people who actually subscribed to your channel. I was one of the first couple of thousand.
Oh, he liked the band before it became popular.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, the second album was crap, but, you know.
No.
You went commercial after that because you just wanted to talk.
The doxing ruined me.
But you got cancelled, yeah. So. But yeah, I remember it was around the same time. I was like, oh, I never would have thought I'd see her on Millennium. Actually, if you don't mind, a slight change of, well, sort of segue, but like, I wouldn't mind you, Wozy, just going over a bit of the history. Because I knew of you when your channel was new, but I watched a few of your videos and I found them, like, they were very long and there was, like, you were speaking quite slowly. And I don't think I used to know about the 1.5 speed thing back then either. I was like, I don't want to watch 2 hours of that, you know, because it was like, and it was generally quite bleak as well, right? I mean, I remained aware of you. I mean, you never left, you know, like I never forgot about you because I was like, this is unusual, this guy. I mean, he's really, really, this is really serious right wing stuff. This is not Douglas Murray. This is not, you know, fucking the Tories. This is like, this guy's talking about race. He's talking about, and all this, and I thought, this is interesting. So I stayed sort of aware of you. But I don't think I was aware of Millennial until about 2018 for some reason. It must have somehow passed me by. And I was never really engaged with any sort of political scene whatsoever myself until even later than that. But I mean, I never took interest in politics on YouTube, so to speak, until about 2013, 2014, when I became aware of this Atheism Plus thing.
Oh, shit.
Oh, and like Karen Strawn was one of the first channels I watched, this sort of anti-feminist woman. And there was Thunderbird. And then Sargon appeared in about 2014, and I was like, yeah, he was anonymous at first. He did a face reveal later when he went to a live event. But of course, Gamergate happened in 2014, and that was, I don't know how you describe it, it was some sort of watershed when a huge like shelf of people all slid heavily to the right. I mean, it was a defeat in itself, Gamergate, because they got what they wanted, the enemy, but it converted what seems like a mass of people into what became the alt-right within the next year or two after that. And like, obviously, Woz, you became part of that. You pretty quickly got in touch with people like Jared Taylor, right, and Richard Spencer, and you would have spoken to Bowden if he'd still been alive, right? And you know, and,
certainly,
yeah, and like, so you've been part of the alt-right thing, you know, since way before it was cool, right? I mean, it became cool in 2016, really.
I started in at the start of 2014, and by that time, the alternative right website. See, so, what I think is going to happen is one day various people will write if not autobiographical books, then they'll write essays or something. There'll be the history of this will be written down from various perspectives. And I imagine, as usually happens, that there will be contradictions. People will remember things differently. But nonetheless, here's my recounting of it as of today. The Alternative Right website started in around 2010, and by, I think, 2013, shut down. There was an acrimonious split there with Colin Liddell and Spencer.
And Andy Nowicki was involved.
And Andy Nowicki. And that was it. Right, the alt-right label was sort of abandoned for about a year, but then TRS started, and they started as libertarians, and then eventually went, you know, nationalist, and somehow that rejuvenated the alt-right label. Then Spencer came back and readopted it, and it became a thing, and that was like, I don't know, the end of 2014, the middle, and. And then 2015 was the year when it really took off.
So and TRS had big forums as well. That helped, didn't it?
Lively
forums.
And so I was, meantime, I had nothing to do with it. I mean, I was very isolated. There was, like, I was in Britain. There wasn't any sort of scene that I was aware of.
None that I knew of, yeah.
And so I was just doing my videos, and I certainly had gone into it with no intention of, I just wanted to ask. It was literally as innocent and naive as it sounds. I just wanted to ask questions and talk to people because I was fucking lonely and very isolated. So that was all I was doing. And then this thing took off, and so I thought, well, it seems to be what we need. It seems to be interesting. It seems to be exciting. And it was so energetic and optimistic and sort of wild. So it was completely different from what I was doing. And indeed, you saw that when I appeared on TRS early on, there was a severe mismatch between their attitude and mine. But I think we liked each other. But there was a very different sort of tone and attitude. So anyway, that happened. And then I was invited. And then toward, at the end of 2015, that was the first millennial. And it happened really by accident. Like, it was originally just supposed to be open hangouts with the general public, with my fans. But Sargon came into the first one. Then that gave me the idea to have a special guest each night because it was going to be 7 nights. So I got in touch with Spencer for the first time. I got in touch with Jared Taylor for the first time. I think I was already in touch with Greg Johnson, so he appeared as well. So that's how that first year happened, and it was very makeshift and at last minute and everything. So that was that. And then 2016 was the year of Trump.
You said part of the aim of it was to. Did you say 2015 was the first one? Or
yeah.
And you said like, because I think you deserve a lot of credit for this. Like, you said part of the aim of it was that people are not alone at Christmas or not isolated, like what you felt, right? Which
exactly.
Like, people, it might be hard to imagine if people are fairly new to this sort of scene or whatever. Like, but my experience of, for me, there was nothing to join. Nothing. Like, you could go on a live stream, maybe. I mean, I didn't even know about Millennial until a certain point. But until 2019, when PA launched, like, there was nothing to join whatsoever in Britain. The BNP seemed to have died. And I mean, I was pretty put off by the BNP anyway. It was kind of like, seemed like a, you know, skinhead. Yeah.
And the London Forum had burnt out as well.
Right. And that was really always a thing that was harassed by Antifa anyway, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And these new riot groups was a similar thing that Bowden used to speak out. Again, they had to have like secret venues and meet-up points and stuff. I mean, PA had the same thing when that launched. They had to have redirection points and all this stuff. That element of things, having to evade Antifa, has actually seems to have somewhat gone away now, because I noticed the TBG, Traditional Britain Group, their last two or three conferences, they've had their venue's been exposed and it hasn't been a problem. The venue, well, the events have gone ahead and it's fine. Like,
well, so. This most recent one, this month, it happened and they had to move to a different venue. And I don't know if the meeting went ahead as planned or not, but there was definitely a big Antifa presence there. And it did cause problems for sure. Antifa is a weird thing. That's a tangent. Because again, it was another thing that seemed to be killed by COVID. but now I don't know, it could resurge at any time because it's a complicated thing. See, there, yeah. I might be misremembering that because they were big with BLM in the middle of 2020. So, but yeah. It seemed to all die down after that. And anyway, that's the whole thing. So the history, millennial, there was 2015, then 16, 17, 18. And yeah, I think that's when you heard about it.
Were they still sort of hangouts the first few years? Or?
Yeah. Well, no, only the first year. And then the second year, I decided to be much more disciplined about it because that first year was really chaotic. I mean, it was like fucking ridiculous, like 6-7 hour hangouts with no discipline at all.
imagine this quite enough. If anybody can get hold of the joining link, that does sound very hazardous.
Yeah. And there were, I mean, it actually went okay. But the thing is, that was then. You know, I only had like 1,000 subscribers at that point. So now I'm going to do one, I think tomorrow, actually, I'm going to do an open to everyone. And we'll just see how it goes. I mean, it might be a fucking shit show. I've no idea. But it probably won't.
You might get a couple of trolls on or something. Yeah.
It might be more entertaining if it is a shit show.
That spelled? Just as we mentioned the internet blood sports earlier, whenabouts did that happen? About 2018 was that? Or
that was 2019? Hold on. Yeah, 2018. January 2018 was the big stream that started it, which again happened by accident. A lot of stuff develops by accident. It's not planned.
I'm actually glad that loads and loads of people didn't turn up for this because I think, like, you know, all you guys know this being content creators, that it's really different to doing a monologuing to a camera or just to a mic, having a one-on-one conversation, a three-way conversation, again, a completely different dynamic again. I think four people is the maximum. Any more, if it's five people, in my mind, it's nearly always too crowded unless most of them have got very, very good sort of mic discipline. And anything above five is a shit show.
Yeah, I agree.
I advise you just mute everyone. Everyone's muted. And you just unmute who you want to speak at any given time. Otherwise, it's just a complete mess, right?
And that's the thing. With that first year of Millennial, I was using Google Hangouts so that it wasn't possible to mute people. You had to ask them to mute themselves. And, of course, they never fucking did. Mm. And meantime, they weren't seasoned streamers. So they would just interrupt and talk over and disagree. It was just very, it was as you would expect for a bunch of guys who were burnt out, depressed about the state of the world and didn't really care about making a good impression, let's say. Now, some of them were fine, but some of them were quite antisocial. I remember one particular guy, what was his name? Rara. And he was just so like pointlessly rude to people, aggressive, and so
we definitely have that element in our scene, don't we?
Yeah,
sure. Yes,
there certainly is a little bit of a skill, or maybe the word is more like anyway, there is a skill to being able to talk in a big group of people and knowing when to be quiet and when to try and step in and when to back off when stepping in didn't really work and on and on and on. And a lot of people, even content creators, sometimes they still haven't really got that, you know, the art of being able to speak when there's 4, 5, 6 people all trying to do it at once.
Exactly. That kind of thing. And they don't, see, now again, another good thing with StreamYard compared to Hangouts is you've got the private chat. So during this, while we're talking, someone can be typing a message saying, "I want to talk next. I've got a point to make," and so on. So this kind of thing, I mean, it's just become a lot more finessed and they've added features like the ability to mute someone who's being a dick.
You'll need that tomorrow. You'll need it.
Oh, definitely. But without having to actually kick them out, which then makes them very pissed off. And then they'll go off and make a video calling you a Jew and a tranny and all the rest of it.
Which is fair.
In my case, yes. But I'm just kidding, everyone. Don't worry.
Colin Rosenstein, yeah.
But yeah, this kind of thing. I do kind of miss the, as I've said before, the sort of rough around the edges nature of Google Hangouts. It was kind of fun because it was so amateurish. But I do think that StreamYard and, you know, the other platforms today make for better content. I think it probably has more, you know, just inherent quality to it. Whereas the appeal of those old ones is that they're so rough around the edges.
It's funny, something you said there's maybe, we probably have all suffered from this, but you say something that's like anti-Islam and you get called a Jew. Or I've been called a Zionist chill and an Arab, like in the same thread, like sometimes. Or like someone calls you like an incel, you still live in your mum's basement. And it's like, it's just so far off the mark.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you
live in your dad's basement. Yeah.
Well, like, it's funny when someone says,
divorced, like, yes.
Call someone in, so it's like, yeah, he's married with kids or whatever. And it's like, yeah, you get called an Arab when I couldn't be less Arab looking, right? You know?
Wow.
What?
Sorry.
But yeah, I just find it funny that now we're in this space where you could get accused of being, like, if you say anything even remotely pro-Jewish or Israeli on any level, like, you get called all sorts of names, where sometimes I'm very anti-Zelensky and I get called pro-Russian, like, I'm literally in the pay of the Kremlin or something, or like, if I wanted to gut out all the Palestinians that got blown up by those little mobile phone and those little bombs, remember earlier in the year? Yeah. Wanted to sort of gloat about that, and you get called
because you're not a big fan of his bollock.
Yeah. Right. And we must have all had it.
Can I? This is a good thing. I wanted to bring this up, actually, the Tommy Robinson stuff. All right, because British politics, you can't really, especially in our sphere, you can't talk about British politics without talking about Tommy. And it's
ridiculous, really, isn't it?
It is. It is very ridiculous.
It seems so absurd that this guy is so prominent.
Yes,
who is a Wally, and yet they can't fucking escape him. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I'm just saying, like, so. Oh God, let's go back in time. I think I made a video about Tommy Robinson in 2017, and it was after I saw him do a speech at the Oxford Union, right? And I watched that speech and I thought, wow, I understand where this guy's coming from. I understand the grievances that he has. He's been personally affected by these things, these grooming gangs. And I thought, you know, this guy at that time was very brave and he was doing some good work. Skip forward from then to now. Now the Tommy Robinson thing is all about Tommy. It's hashtag save Tommy every single fucking week. It is not about the issues that he was built up to represent. It is about him. It's always about him. And this is a problem. And of course, okay, Ezra Levant and Rebel Media have a huge part to play in this. Let's not forget. But the pressure that you feel online, all these people saying, you need to support Tommy. Nigel Farage is like, okay, you need to support Tommy. No, this is a fucking, it's ridiculous. This is a cult of personality. I can't stand this anymore. In British politics, it's so bad.
His whole thing jumped the shark like 5 years ago as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the worst thing is that he is a gatekeeper. You know, it's not just that he is hogging attention and constantly getting into pointless trouble and all that. And, you know, a lot of that might be engineered against him. I don't think that he's a willing. I mean, I don't think that he's a Fed. I think it's kind of
me neither.
More weird than that. I think that he might actually think that. I don't know. I don't know if there's any direct contact between him and the British state, and they're saying to him, "Hey, go here on this date, and we'll arrest you." And yeah, that's the next chapter. So you've just got to do it. I don't know. I think more likely it's all sort of clumsy and ad hoc, and they're just playing him and taking advantage and all this. And after all, he telegraphs what he's going to do in advance. So, you know, it's all one way or the other. It's a runaround. And as Morgoth once characterized it, it's like Hope Not Hate are chasing Tommy around the building endlessly. And, you know, you see him and then you see them and they disappear around the corner and then you see him again. And that's it's just a sort of endless punch and duty show. Yeah. But the worst part of it is that even with all of that going on, he's also a gatekeeper. So,
I wonder, I might have figured out how that works. I think maybe like he is what he appears to be, but at some point, perhaps when he was in prison in 2019, but probably earlier, being in prison, having a genuinely bad time because the kitchen's controlled by Muslims and he wasn't eating and, you know, about this, like, you know, he'd been sent food and stuff. I think maybe, in those circumstances, at some point, like maybe Special Branch or MI5 or whoever, like, has a word with him and says, look, right, we don't really want to see you here. What you've done doesn't warrant all this. Like, but you could help us out by just, and we know you already agree with us, like going after the Nazis, like by which they mean, you know, ethnics. And like, they just say to him, like, we can make things easier for you if you just help us. You hate them anyway, don't you? You know, you've got all these Caribbean friends and, you know, you've always been a multiculturalist. Just help us like message against the Nazis, against the neo-Nazis, the ethnics, right? And I can imagine he's very susceptible to that because he believes in that. Because he is a multiculturalist, right? He just believes that Islam, specifically radical Islam, shouldn't take over. That's all. But apart from that, he's like centre left. So I don't think there would be. It doesn't even take any particular conspiracy. It's just like, can you just help us out against the real fascists?
Yeah, and we'll make things a bit less bad for you than otherwise.
Yeah,
I've had this line I've been trying to say for a while now. Whenever I talk about if there's something going down in Yemen or the Israeli-Palestinian-Iranian conflict, or the Russian and Ukrainian thing, whatever it is, I just say, no, I refuse to take a side. It's not our war. It's got nothing to do with us. Now, I'm not going to choose a side in the Russia-Ukraine thing, in the Israeli-Palestine thing. And then you get accused. You can easily get accused of being pro one side or the other just by taking that stance. But I say this, you know, you get someone like Tommy Robinson and someone like Keith Woods, right? Someone like Tommy Robinson is so anti-Islam that he ends up wearing a T-shirt saying Mossad on it, right? Right? And then you get someone like Keith Woods, who's so anti-Jewish that he's almost pro-Islam. I mean, that's a bit unfair, but you know what I'm saying, right?
One struggle.
And I'll be like, no, I'm not Jewish and I'm not Islamic, okay? Yeah. No, I want nothing to do with the Torah or the Quran. Thank you very much. But then you get people saying, oh, well, that attitude in and of itself defaults to being pro-Jewish or something, or some other bullshit people say.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not having it. No, I'm not. I will not pick a side. And people that do, I think, are sort of profoundly misunderstand what they're doing when they do that. You know, I think.
But the Tommy Robinson crowd are very, because their entire thing is about Muslims and Islam and grooming gangs, it's very easy to get. You need to support Israel because Israel are fighting against Muslims. That's the only thing. That there's no deeper thought there. It's just you hate Muslims, they hate Muslims. Fine, good. There's your connection. That's it. There's no deeper thought there.
I mean, I would assume that traces back to just Israel itself. Like, Israel has just paid people like him to say that because it just works. It's like they're defending us according to that line of argument.
Yeah, and that in turn goes back to the 2000s, like the counter-jihad. Because I remember when I first started to get red-pilled, like around 2006, 2007, I started to read stuff online. And it was the Vlad Tepes blog, the Gates of Vienna blog, I can't remember what else, but it,
When blogs used to have like a load of links to other blogs down the side, and you know,
yeah. That moment in time, yeah.
Good old days.
And there were various people who were big hitters in that. Like one of them was Daniel Pipes. There was another one. What the hell was his name? Fjordman. And they turned out to be Jewish. And
it's David Horowitz as well.
Of course. Yeah. But even people that you would think wouldn't be, like, you know, someone called Fjordman, it's not exactly the most Hebraic sounding name. But I'm fairly sure he turned out to be Jewish. And then Daniel Pipes as well. I think he was in America. But there were various ones. And it was really weird. So they're going on about the danger of Islam. They're citing all this evidence and talking about the stuff that just happened, news stories and all that. And so I was getting really into it. And I had no idea about other matters at that point. I was fairly racially aware. And that was sort of dawning on me at that time that I just want my own people to be okay. And that's white people. That was dawning on me. But my main thing at that point was just Islam, because I saw that as a genuine threat and frightening. And I was worrying about it.
Not wrongly at all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that scene played into that and sort of encouraged that. Now, and that is that's the function that's been taken over by people like Tommy Robinson. It would be interesting to chart this, because I think that he and Farage were sort of selected in some sense, in some way, as around about 2010, maybe later, this is going to be the acceptable, we're going to make this the acceptable face of nationalism. Or this is what is going to be, in the same way that Jordan Peterson was selected on YouTube as the limit of right-wing thinking. I think 10 years earlier, Tommy Robinson, Nigel Farage was selected to replace the BNP in the British political scene. Yeah. Tommy Robinson was selected to replace, the National Front or whatever, with the English Defence League, which was a heavily Zionist, Jewish...
Who made it that, though?
Yeah. It wasn't in the first place. Well, it was originally called the English and Jewish Defence League.
Yeah, but that that was kind of a gay-op as well, it seems, because... I did an interview with Joe Marsh about 3 years ago. People can see it on my Odyssey channel if you want. Really interesting. Joe Marsh was one of the leading figures in what was that movement before it was called the English Defence or the English and Jewish
Defence. Is he the Welsh guy?
Yeah, and he's like...
Yeah,
he's
I remember him.
He's from South Wales. Yeah, he's still an activist for PA now. He's one of the most energetic, devoted guys. He's great. But he was one of the first people who started these assemblies that became the English Defence League, of, you know, like what are called casuals, right? As in, like, more the hooligan side of football fans, right? The harder guys. he was one of them. And he said, yeah, like, we had a thing going. And it totally wasn't Zionist or Sivnat or anything like that. It wasn't overtly racialist. It wasn't necessarily, didn't have the intellectual sort of content for that. But it was just fairly straightforward British patriotism, and especially outrage about Muslim crimes against little girls and Muslim insults against soldiers, like dead soldiers and stuff. And he said he watched Tommy Robinson, I think Kevin Carroll as well, and like a couple other figures, including that, I think that guy who called it the English and Jewish Defence League, these sort of crusader image sort of guys. He watched them come in, and he said, like, within weeks of them coming in, they were having these strange interactions with American Jews like Daniel Pipes, and they were bringing in the rainbow flag and talking about gay rights, and it was like, what the fuck? Like, this is just a takeover. He watched it happen. So if anybody wants to watch that interview on my Odyssey channel, but yeah, like, so the original composure of that movement wasn't Zionist, but it was Zio-opt in about 2011 or something, 2010.
Right. Again, this is something that I've realized recently. I've talked about this on Millennial this year, how important it is for things to be, for interviews to be done about historical events, because otherwise it will be a different history that gets recorded. So it's vital, you know, that might be from Joe Marsh. That might be the only account from that perspective. of right. that event. Yeah, you know,
it's very interesting. It should absolutely be done and started soon. One thing I thought was interesting, you saying there that, like, in a sense, Nigel Farage was selected, or Tommy was selected, to be sort of the avant-garde of containment or something like that. It's interesting to note, though, that Reform, particularly Nigel and Richard Tice, don't want anything to do with Tommy and his supporters whatsoever. They're completely beyond the pale.
But that shores up their position. Right?
Yeah, it makes sense. In fact,
it shores up both positions, because it makes Tommy seem dangerous and exciting to his
unleashed.
Exactly. Whereas for Nigel Farage, he's more sort of Little Englander, middle class, rural village kind of supporters. It makes him seem safe. It makes Nigel Farage seem safe and reasonable. It's actually mutually beneficial, given their different fan bases.
Tommy Robinson is the head of the unintellectual dork web.
Well, I mean, so many people have said so many things about Tommy Robinson, and I've never had any contact with him at all, but I've been friends with people who I know were in regular contact with him, and it's kind of weird. It's like, it's like ships passing in the night, really. But I've never had any interest in being in contact with him, because I think, you know, he I don't think we'd have much to say to each other, basically.
He's a strange guy. I think Lucy Brown, for example, that I talk to regularly, she worked with him for a long time, and there's a lot of personal problems with Tommy that have come to light. And but I think my problem with him is everything is about him. It's not the issues, it's about him. It's
Save Tommy. Yes,
It's the Tommy Show. Yeah, you've got to get him out of jail. You've got to give him money. You've got to what the fuck? You know, who knows, right? And I feel sad, because back in the day he was literally, I think he was genuine. I think he rallied the troops, so to speak, and it was like, okay, we need to stop these immigrant gangs raping our fucking girls. You know, that's it.
Yes.
It's not that way anymore.
I agree. And the thing is, he is, whatever you think about him, he clearly has a tremendous sort of charisma. Like, for that type of person, he is...
He can speak to people, yes. Yes.
And he's got a lot of energy and gusto and arrogance, which is what you need in someone like that. In some ways, he is an ideal sort of candidate for that role. But I think that's also how he was seen by subverters. So either they selected him, or he was already there, selected himself. But either way, I think it was taken over. And, well, as Horace has just illustrated, that is exactly what happened.
Yeah,
it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, I think it's been quite clear that something happened there. My only uncertainty was whether it was like that from the very beginning, or whether it was subverted early on.
One thing I would say is that for all my reservations, you know me, I work for Lotus Eaters, so I think it's an important job to try and bridge the gap between reality and the normies, the boomers with their heads in the sand. Right? I think that's a really, really important role, is to try and wake up people, to try and drag them away from the left, to move the Overton window to the right, to do all those things. Right. So I've got my reservations about Tommy. But I went to their last big rally in Trafalgar Square this summer. And it was remarkable. I mean, the whole of Trafalgar Square and a fair few of the streets leading off of it were jam-packed. And I've never seen, don't mean to be out of order, but PA couldn't manage that, right?
Sure.
UKIP could not manage that. Homeland couldn't manage that. I went to the UKIP, the joint UKIP English Democrat party. What's the yearly party conference? There's like 20, 30 people there, 40 people. So, like, what Tommy does is he, if nothing else, is to get people out. And that's not nothing. I know even Morgoth, who I highly, highly respect. There's few people I respect more in this space than Morgoth. But, you know, he would say, you know, never go to a rally, never go to any sort of protest. There's no point. You're just playing their games. You'll get yourself arrested. You'll give us a bad name. Da, 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 da. I do happen to think that peaceful protest, turning out en masse and not doing anything illegal, is of value.
That recent one's quite surprising as well, because I had the impression that, like, the relevance of Tommy Robinson had dwindled to very little. But, like, that was his biggest assembly of people ever, right?
There was thousands and thousands of people. When they all bellowed at once, it was really quite something.
Yeah, well, I remember saying to you, there was another demo about a year ago. I think it was to the Cenotaph Remembrance Day last year. And for days before, about a week or so before, loads and loads of people, probably including me, were saying, it's very unwise to go to this. It just seems like a trap to get arrested. And people did get arrested, including Tommy and stuff. But I still found myself a little proud of the guys who just went and confronted the state, basically. I couldn't help feeling some pride in them. Like, they are getting out. They are a physical presence. It's not my forte, but I kind of respect them for doing that.
It is a sense of confusion for me, because everything you just said, I completely support. But, oh God, I mean, Rebel Media, Tommy, you feel the split, don't you? Feel the split. However, you know, let me just say this. Boomers, right? My parents are boomers. And what I've realized is boomers need some perceived authority figure to tell them what to believe. And then they'll think that way. So my mother, she's about 65 years old. She watches YouTube on the TV. And she watches Candace Owens all the time, right? Post Daily Wire. And Candace Owens, I didn't see this, but Candace Owens had a survivor of the USS Liberty on as a guest, right? And I went down to my parents' house, and she's saying to me, Dan, did you know that Israel?
Did you know that? Love it. My mum's not at that stage yet, I'll tell you.
Did you know that Israel murdered all these American sailors? Like,
we should put iconoclast mum in touch with Horace's mum to red pill her.
That's fine by me. That's fine, yeah.
I was laughing before she finished the sentence. I said, I did try and tell you about this about 6 years ago or some shit. And she's like, no, but Candace Owens is...
Right.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, the point is that the people need like an authority figure to believe certain things. And I don't know, man. I mean, the boomers are dying out. It's a shame. I mean, is it? It is a shame, my parents. But it's funny to go along that road.
I thought, it's definitely...
fantastic.
It's definitely the case that boomers are worse for... like, when I was doing some stuff with Reform, I came into contact with a load of boomers. And this is what I found about them. Like, sort of semi-based boomers, or boomers on the journey of becoming more right-leaning or something. They'll latch on to one person, like Candace Owens, or like Maya Tusi, or like...
Douglas Murray.
Yeah, so like
Constantine Kissing.
Oh, God.
Or Constantine, yeah. They'll latch on to one of these people and then just watch them, like just that person, but loads of them. Whatever they put out, they're watching. And they've not even heard of loads of other people and loads of other stuff. Like Paul Joseph Watson. A lot of these boomers like Maya Tusi, Paul Joseph Watson, and Constantine Kissing.
Is PJW still around? Like, is he still around?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. And they'll latch onto that thing. And hopefully, you know, hopefully it's just part of their journey, and they will go further and continue. But that is the problem with boomers, you know, refusing to abandon the BBC. Or they're on Facebook, and they're familiar with Facebook, and they refuse to go any further into social media. They're happy with their one thing.
I'll go you one better. They're on Facebook in a massive group called I Hate the BBC. And even though that group's 5 years old, and they've all like been telling each other to fucking switch it off for years, they're still complaining about the programme they watched on the BBC last night.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah.
But the thing is, we all might end up in exactly the same, you know, condition where, well, we've got StreamYard. Why do we need anything else? Kind of, sort of thing, you know?
Hmm. Oh, from the content creator's point of view, it's different because there's a whole load of work switching to a new instrument or a new, you know, platform or whatever. But those are the people.
Well, I mean, even TikTok, right? Think like I think I'm sort of fossilized because it's like I've got Twitter.
Fuck it.
You know, I've got Telegram.
I'm trying to keep up with everything. It's mad. Yeah. Like, things change too quickly. You'd have spent years on Snapchat if you tried to keep up with everything, right? But what Dan and Bo just described there, like that is like those are the people who containment efforts are aimed at, right? That's who it works on. It's like, yeah, get yourself into this kind of slick, like exciting new guy, Maya Tusi, who's a fucking rebel. Like you're really caring.
My mother loves watching him, I'll tell you. Yeah, straight up.
All right, I'm glad my mum's not red pilled now. There you go. She's not. But yeah, like, you know, they care primarily who is speaking. I trust that person. I'm generally going to go along with what that person's saying. And it takes a hell of a lot for them to lose trust in each one. Even though they've lost trust in others before and moved over, they don't learn the lesson because they really, really want authority figures. What it is in their makeup or how they were brought up, I don't know. But they really don't want to abandon people. They don't want to decide that they distrust, you know, they don't want to decide that person's dead to me now, that I don't trust them anymore. They don't want to do it. They resist it. They want to stay in a cul-de-sac. And they want to feel like it's not a cul-de-sac. It's just so perverse, you know.
Also, there is this thing in the human condition that a lot of people suffer from, is that you feel like it's humiliating or embarrassing to change your mind or admit to the world that what I used to think for the last 30 years is bullshit. And so they will just keep lying to themselves rather than actually admit that what they've done
or how they were wrong. Yeah, and also that their whole worldview is just out of date. That's a fucking depressing thing for anyone to face up to. Mm. I remember, I've told this story before, I was trying to talk to this boomer woman on Facebook, and she was a family friend. I'd known her most of my life, and forgotten how we... I was trying to get through to her about, you know, Rotherham and the associated nationwide grooming of white girls by Pakistanis.
Good luck.
And somehow she changed it to the miners' strike in 1984.
Oh, right, yeah, great.
And okay, it's like... It's like, you know, it's a class thing, class conflict, a class war. And I thought, you just don't know what the modern world is. You just don't know. It's like that you're living in the modern world, but you're living really in the 80s, in, you know, 40 years ago. And it's sad and it's sort of exasperating, but at the same time, I can't help thinking, be careful what you say, because we might be in like that, so, you know, 20 years from now. There might well be people saying, you just don't get it. You just don't know what life in the 2040s is like.
I wonder, whenever we talk about boomers, I think obviously, like this has been said before, but you've got to think about the generation that raised them or the two generations that raised them as well. But about the boomers, it does seem like there's something that, like the most aggressively conformist people, and it's not conformism in every way, because, you know, they were like part of the 60s counterculture as well, but like they're the most conformist to something, like the ideas of when they grew up or something, the 60s, like, I don't know exactly what it is. They're like, I mean, they tend to love the state, even the more sort of libertarian side of them. Like they tend to love, because they grew up in the, you know, the cradle to grave state, right? 1945 to 75, roughly, where you really were provided for and it really was cheap to buy a house and so on, right? They attribute, like, they think that 30-year period was a good time, and you compare everything that happened since to that, you know? It's not as simple as that, because the boomers ain't as, you know, they are actually really hard to describe, but there's a certain strong, really, really strong will to conform to something, to be in a club as well. You know, I think Kevin McDonald's idea of the moral community is very important, but as to why that applies so strongly to the boomers, I don't really know. But it is they try to stay within the pen themselves. They try to stay within containment, you know, like God, it's so frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that they are they're dying out, basically. Let's just be honest. The boomers are dying right now. My parents in their mid-60s, they're going to be dead in 10 years. Sorry to be morbid, but that's the way it is. here's the truth. I think the boomers are the last generation that believe in the institutions of this country. So the institutions of Britain, they think, okay, these things have merit. But now, from my perspective, as a millennial, an old one, I think, no, the institutions of the country are terrible. Nobody believes in them anymore. And when the faith in these institutions collapses, then the country's over. That is the collapse. That is the end of it. Law and order, for example. Two-tier Kia. That's the truth. It's not just a catchy fucking hashtag. That's the truth. Two-tier Kia. Law and order, criminal justice, done. Immigration, nonsense. The monarchy, fucking hell. The monarchy? Really? Charles? Are you, really? Okay, fine. Great. Everyone loves Charles. Done. Over. You know, all these institutions are going to fail, and the boomers, I think, are the last people that are holding on to them. When they're gone, you know, the entire country is up for grabs, so to speak. I think
it's very important thing you said there. Like, I think this applies in America as well. Like, in say, you watch stuff from maybe the 50s or 60s, it's really common to see people react with outrage against anyone who questions the institutions at all. Like, there really was total conformity from a large majority of the population, it seems. And probably the same in Britain. And we grew up, I mean, you're like a little bit younger than the rest of us, I think, Dan, but like sort of 80s, 90s, right? We
35.
Right, and I'm like, oh yeah, I wasn't saying I'm 80s or 90s. but like, I think our generation, if we're one generation, like we never had that deep-seated trust in the institutions. We had a little bit of it. You know, we obviously had to trust our teachers and stuff, but like, and the BBC was kind of still auntie, but it was nowhere near as much as it was for our parents growing up. They really were like, I don't know, they were really cuddled by the state or something. I don't know, like coddled.
See, I think it's, I do agree with the general point, but I think, speaking from my own perspective, my own observations of, you know, but again, you've also got to factor in your particular circumstances. Like, a rural town in Scotland is not going to be the same as an industrial town in Yorkshire, for example. But anyway, my perception of this is that we grew up, there was still, for us, for our generation, I think there was a lot of trust in the country. Maybe not in individual institutions, but in the idea of society as a big thing that would take care of you. And I think the betrayal, that the disillusionment for me and I think a lot of the people around me, didn't happen in childhood. It was later. It was like when we were in our early 20s. That I think that was our mid-20s. I think we were still young enough to change and become cynical and so on, and sort of get very hurt by it, get very let down by it. Again, I've got to be careful not to just inject my own story into this. I think my perception is that the millennials were not cynical at all growing up, but that it's happened after the fact. It's happened in our 20s and 30s.
I think there's a lot of truth to that.
I think it's interesting to look at. I'm fascinated by the Falklands War. I did a bit of content on it before. And I think it's very, very interesting to look at how Britain seems to have behaved in the Falklands, i.e. the very early 80s. And then how they behave, how we behaved with the second Gulf War going into Afghanistan and Iraq. It's obviously about 20, just a bit over 20 years apart, about 20 years apart. And the Falklands, everyone was still, it seems very much largely, it was still sort of gung ho. Yes, our government has said we've got to do this and it's a righteous thing to do and we'll accept the sacrifices. And let's have bunting out when we win and let's all get behind the boys sort of a thing, right? And then you look at Gulf War II, certainly going into Basra and Iraq, and it seems like there's some sort of sea change in sort of the public perception about these things. It was no longer, oh, the government has told us we've got to do, because Blair would even say that sort of thing, you know, let's not talk about who did what wrong. We've started it now, so everyone just needs to get behind it. People didn't really buy that in 2004 or whatever.
And big demonstrations for months before as well, before the invasion.
And we buy even less now. I mean, if you go back and you look at this is a bit more of an extreme historical example, but if you go back and look at the world pre-World War One, the world as it existed before 1914, it would seem insane to us now the amount of trust that people had in the institutions and in their state and in their government and in their king and their priests and all sorts of things. It would seem naive to the point of being childish to us now, I think. I think it's accelerated even more just in the last 20, 30 years. If it was plotted on a graph, it would just be going almost vertically up now, people's lack of trust or people's cynicism in it all. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. I don't know.
It's good. It's kind of unavoidable, isn't it? I mean, the institutions are captured by bad people. It's like a world in which we could trust the institutions might be a good one. We just don't have that choice.
Right. No, good point. Yeah. Good point.
I think it's a very interesting... It's always interesting to contrast two fairly similar historical events. I think you get a lot from doing that. It's interesting. And there... Bo mentioned the contrast between the Falklands War and the Afghanistan-Iraq War. So there's 20 years in between there, 20, 22 years, I can't remember. Apart from the shift in attitudes, like the people changing, you've also got to bear in mind that a lot of people would have died in that time. So in 1980, I'm going to find out when the Falklands War was. I think it was 81, but I always get this mixed up.
Summer of 82.
Right, 82, okay. 82. So that's 20 years. At that point in 82, there would still have been a lot of people alive that, you know, to us now would seem really reactionary. I mean, the attitudes to the empire and so on, the fuzzy wuzzies and the wogs and all that. There'd be people who had, everyday people, who had attitudes that today would be shocking even to us, I think. And so that is why when you say, well, like with the Falklands, you say we're protecting the dignity of the empire. This is for the empire. Where today that is absolutely alien to really everyone in Britain, even us. I mean, I don't think we have any particular, I mean, the empire is a long time ago. We didn't, it was before we were born, really, it was over. Decades before we were born. So it's not something that we identify with. And so it would seem ridiculous for us to go to war to protect the dignity of the British Empire. I mean, it's fucking absurd. But in 1982, I think there were still enough people alive that it didn't seem, clearly it didn't seem absurd because they did it and the public were on board. But the huge change happened in the 20 years after that. I think a lot of people simply died off. And by 2002, 2003, there is just wasn't that any sort of imperial self-image on the part of the British people. And furthermore, as a separate issue, the rationale for going to war, nobody really bought it or understood it. And Tony Blair, as someone said, tried to sell it, but everyone thought, this doesn't add up. And it didn't add up. And we now know that it was a load of bollocks.
But he's just an ordinary guy. He likes a pint, you know. Why not vote for him?
He's a... I think he described himself as a straight-up guy.
Just a pretty ordinary guy who went to a public school and, you know, barrister and that. Yeah.
I think you're right. Like, if... I mean, it wasn't the empire by 1982, but it's still the Commonwealth, right? It's that the Falklands are part of our overseas dependencies or whatever, and we cannot stand for the aggression coming out of Buenos Aires. I mean, like, say today, I don't know, I'm just making this up, but say Mexico tried to invade St. Kitts.
Say Argentina invades the Falklands again.
Oh, well, yeah, okay, yeah, say that.
Because they won't.
Would there be, obviously the government, I'm sure, would shit its pants and completely capitulate, but would there be any public support for, you know, sending an aircraft carrier down there and possibly losing a few thousand young men. I don't know.
I mean, from me, there would be, yes. I would support that for sure.
Well, I would, but I'm talking about whether...
Just for the memes, you know.
The public opinion. Would public opinion be behind it in the general...
No, of course not. But I do want to go to war with Mexico. I think that'd be funny. That'd be good.
Just any rationale will do, really.
Let's just go to war for the memes and have a good time. Who cares?
We saw what Starmer and co think of the Chagos Islands. I don't know if that's a different issue, but obviously they were just quite happy to just go, yeah, have it. Yeah, just have it. It's yours. Yeah, go.
Our military is so bad that we need to just go to war with some shit nation and win.
Well,
and then we like, okay, see, we won. We won a war.
Because if Argentina just invaded again today, I don't know whether there's enough forces. I bet the quality of British forces is still really high. I expect that hasn't degraded a lot, but it's much smaller. It's just much smaller. Like, they've got rid of loads of ships and tanks.
Well, it's all the drones now. That we've got drones. You know, all these... Oh, my God. Should we get into the drone sightings above... New Jersey. Should we get into that? Right. No, I don't think this is the right room.
When Blair was prime, I remember during the war on terror, the definitely real meaningful war on terror. Like Blair just said, like, yeah, the reason we're like massively cutting down the army across every category, every kind of arms and everything, was like, oh yeah, well, it's to adapt to the new battles that will take place in the war of terror, as if there's going to be like actual battlefields with Al Qaeda.
Yeah, right.
So really what he meant was he wanted to reduce the army anyway because it makes us powerful. And it was probably something to fit with the EU, something like the new EU army that still hasn't come about. But because they just used to hide stuff to conform with the EU behind everything. But like, yeah, so like the British force has just been massively cut down.
We just need to import all these high-skilled Indians to operate the drones. That's it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's what we do.
But like, I just remember one big difference with the second Gulf War as well, as Beau mentioned, like, was I was listening because there was months of demonstrations against it beforehand. There was nothing like that with either the first Gulf War or the Falklands, or as someone pointed out on the radio at the time, with the Vietnam War either. Demonstrations started after it had been going on for several years.
The Iraq War in 2003. So I was
talking about the Vietnam War. Somebody pointed out on the BBC at the time, like back in 2003. I was listening to all these debates over whether to go to war or not, and someone said, like, by the way, one difference now is that we've had demonstrations for the last few months, and we haven't even invaded yet. But in the Vietnam War, demonstrations against it didn't start until the war had been happening. Like US forces had been engaged for a couple of years. Right. So like anti-war sentiment as a whole. It's just a much, much stronger thing, as well as what we're talking about, you know, the opposition to, you know, distrust of the institutions and stuff.
Engagement with the nation state. I mean, you know, any war can be justified if people believe in, yeah, this is for Britain, this is for whatever. But right now, the crucial problem is that people just don't identify with, their country, because they know that their country is against them. So why would they... You know, and then culturally, people are into stuff that's international, global. You know, so why? You know, I just don't know how you would get people at this point to fight. And there have been surveys that have borne this out that, you know, a majority of young men just wouldn't fight for Britain or England.
I would fight for Britain, but that means not joining this regime, obviously. Who's going to fight for this regime under the command of like Michael Gove or whatever? You know, it's like whoever, I don't even know, Ben Wallace. Like, he's a moron. Like,
Ben Wallace. I'd fight for Ben Wallace, not Michael Gove.
Field Marshal Miliband leading the troops personally.
Yeah, fuck that. Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, the thought of fighting under this regime is laughable. It's not even a serious idea. You know?
Exactly, because you can see that they're not fighting for this country. I mean, these politicians, they've got no interest in the country at all. So if when they tell you to go to war for this country, you'd be a complete fool to trust them.
I'm glad that they sort of did their thing over the last year or two of floating the idea. You know, they put out the idea through the Telegraph and these adverts and stuff. And there was just an instant reaction, like, fuck off. Absolutely not. Absolutely no way.
Yeah. That was sweet to see.
In the live chat, someone said, I was there in 82. The educated youth was anti-jingoistic. That's right. Exactly what I would expect. I'm glad someone pointed that out because I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, yeah.
The imperialists, the ones who were pro the war, would have been the old farts who still remembered, you know, the 60s and the 50s and the 40s. So the young would have been anti all of this. So that is a really good point.
It is a very good point. There's always a counterculture. I mean, I talked about World War One, how the pre-1914 years almost described it as like a caricature, a cartoon of brainwashed, credulous buffoons doing whatever they're told. No, there was a massive anti-war movement before 1914, massive pro-peace movement, which we very rarely gets talked about in your history textbooks. Very rarely. Before World War II, we're not really encouraged to remember it much because everything Churchill did was perfect and Mr. Hitler was the ultimate evil that must be confronted and annihilated. So we're not really expected to remember the massive anti-war movement before 1939. But it was always there. No, absolutely always there. Good, it was a good point.
It's one of the key things about writing history once you've won the war is you've got to just massively downplay or disparage the opposition, obviously.
There's that famous Norm, I've forgotten his name, Norm MacDonald tweet. I just read that every war was won by the good guys. What are the odds?
Yeah, it's just, that's funny. Can I ask a question for history rule? So, have you seen the Netflix remake of All Quiet on the Western Front? Have you seen that?
I went to cinema to see it. Yeah, a friend of mine won tickets to see it on the IMAX. His bird wasn't interested in that, so I got to go. I thought it was very good. I thought it was very good. All Quiet on the Western Front is quite a touching story.
Why would a woman care about the plight of young European men? Yes, incredible.
I thought it was done well. I thought it looked good. The main actor carried it enough that it wasn't. He didn't ruin it. So yeah.
Do you agree that World War One was essentially the end of Europe as we knew it?
In a sense, yeah. I believe that World War One. This is a glib, broad thing to say.
Sure.
But I think certainly for Western Europe, it committed suicide with World War One. I think that we absolutely still live deeply in the shadow of World War One. I believe that the World War Two and World War Two are merely ripples after World War One.
What a waste. What a fucking waste of life that was. And, you know, was it last year, 2023, when that that tourist submarine went down to find the Titanic wreck?
Yeah.
Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. And I thought, fucking hell.
Titus?
I can't remember. It was some ridiculous bullshit. But the Titanic itself, that glorious ship, was that 20? That was 1912, right?
Yeah.
That's when it sank. And that was before World War One. That was, I think that was the end of Europe, wasn't it? Like that was symbolic. That was the end of Europe. Yeah. And now in modern day times, you've got these fucking idiots going down to try and find the wreck. Like, what are you doing? Come on. you absolute retards.
Well, it's because that diamond is down there somewhere, isn't it?
Yeah. There is this thing when you look back at history, and this goes back to the ancient world, that you always look back on a previous era and think that it was better then.
Sure.
Not everyone does it, but even in the Iliad, even in Homer's Iliad, there's old man Nestor, the oldest man among them, who said, when I was a boy, men were stronger, women were more virtuous, everything was better when I was a boy. And he's saying that deep in the Bronze Age. Right. Yeah. So there's this idea that before World War One it was okay, but people in World War One were looking back to the very early Victorian period or the Georgian period and saying things were better then, men were real men back then. They're all pansies now. People were saying that at like the turn of the 20th century, right?
So
it's sort of always the way. However, However, having said that, to varying degrees, sometimes it's absolutely more true than others. There is this oscillation of the civilization of men between hard times create hardened people, and that soft times, easy times, peaceful times make for degenerate weaklings. I think we happen to have had, some people have called the world since 1945 the long peace. Obviously, if you lived in a part of the world where there's been wars since 1945, you wouldn't think of it as a long peace. Nevertheless, there's this idea on the broadest sense, global conflicts, that there's been a long peace, that lots of people in America, in the West, have not needed to fight. And so it's made for 2-3 generations of weak people, both morally and physically. So I think that at the moment we are at quite a low ebb. I think it is fair to say that the generations that came before us in the early 20th century or the 19th century were of a different stripe, a different breed, a harder men. Right. but it will oscillate. The pendulum will swing back, and at some point there'll be some sort of terrible war, because that's the way it has always been, which will make for harder people again. I think that is what we're doomed to repeat these patterns, really.
Maybe a new kind of war.
Right. Oh, well, yeah. By the way, but since I've got you here, what do you think of Graham Hancock and his kind of ancient history? What do you think about that?
Oh, I've got, God, I could talk about Graham Hancock for a while. I've got really mixed feelings about Graham Hancock. I both really, really like him, and dig loads of things he says, and also on small little bits here and there, hold him in contempt and are pretty sure he's talking complete bollocks.
My perspective, as just a regular idiot, right, that just likes this stuff, I want it to be true, you know, so that's my bias. I want it to be true, but obviously, so, you know, whatever.
There's things like we were talking about earlier where someone like Ben Shapiro or Tommy Robinson or Constantine Kissing can talk a lot of good sense, but then there's this whole other angle to them which is nonsense. So I feel like that with Graham Hancock. I'm fascinated by the idea that there were civilizations deep in the last ice age and before, which are now lost to us. But I do need the evidence. And Graham Hancock will fall back on, will say, well, the whole world hasn't been excavated by archaeologists yet. So
aliens.
So the evidence might still be out there yet to be found. We haven't really done much archaeology in the Amazon or in the Sahara, for example. And the evidence might be sitting there waiting for future archaeologists to find. It's like, well, until they do, so I love Graham Hancock. I would love to sit down and pick Graham Hancock's mind. I would love to have a conversation with him. But there's whole things he says which are shaky. He does make some shaky arguments.
Mate, so anyway, I would love it if the Lotus Eaters got Hancock on. Come on.
I would love it. It would be a treat
fucking
and a
hell.
Pleasure.
That'd be amazing.
And I would probably be a bit too referential to him. But he's an interesting... there's nothing worse than being boring, is there? And,
no.
One of the worst things you can do with your life is to spend it being boring. And Graham Hancock certainly isn't that, I think we can say.
So we come back to Francis Foster. Okay, yeah. Full circle.
I've got to say, I've never heard of this Graham Hancock. Who is it?
You're fucking retarded, Wars. Come on.
I think
the Anunnaki flew past on Nibiru and mated with the original Denisovians and produced Homo sapiens or whatever.
He's been an author and a historian since like the 80s, or certainly since the 1990s. He wrote Fingerprints of the Gods and the other one, Something Else of the Gods. So he's been around for a long, long time. I mean, he's been on Joe Rogan a number of times. He's a best-selling author type guy, and did a Netflix show in recent times. He's just an alternative history dude that suggests that maybe there's lost civilizations and stuff.
He's from Edinburgh. Okay. Sorry, everyone.
But no, I, uh, after what I've said, and I've expressed that view before, exactly that view before, that I like him and fascinated by him, would love to have a conversation, but disagree with him about X, Y, Z. I don't think he would talk to me, but I would love it personally. But there you go.
I think he's very interesting. I don't think you've got a Netflix account, but if you do, there's two seasons of Ancient Apocalypse, which is headed by him, Graham Hancock.
Right.
Yeah. So it's all about ancient civilizations beyond what the regular historians would tell you.
So, for example, I don't put any stock in numerology at all. If you add all these numbers up, then and then divide it by this or that, then it, you know, I think all that is kind of nonsense. But so, like, he'll talk about the Great Pyramid, and for like an hour and a half, he'll talk about nothing but firm history, and not deviate, not talk about anything that isn't good, firm, solid evidence. And then at the end, do a quick 15 minutes about numerology and aliens, and it's like, why did you have to ruin it? So I know, like, Horace is a massive fan of David Icke, for example. Follows David Icke.
Beg your pardon. I did go see him speak once.
And David Icke is a bit like that. He's worse than Graham Hancock. But you get him talking. get David Icke talking about like George Bush or something, and it's great stuff. You can't fault it.
He's a lizard.
Correct. And then at the end, he'll just talk about interdimensional lizards. You're like, yet to ruin it. Oh no.
Ike might seem a bit staid these days. He might have not moved with the times. Like, times have just got crazier in general, haven't they? Like, people believe in all sorts. So yeah. Ike might just be quite ordinary now.
Yeah. Well, he was right about Elon Musk. Fucking hell. He was totally right. He hated him from the start. He hated Musk.
Yeah. Like, for the same reasons as us? Probably not.
Yeah, right? Like, the chip in the brain, aren't you?
I'm up for the chip in the brain. Let's go.
Is that the same reason Thunderfoot hates Elon? What's Chunderfoot's boggle with Elon anyway? What is it? Does anyone actually know?
He just says everything Musk says he's going to do is bullshit, I think. Like, all the solar roads, I think that actually was bullshit. But like a tunnel from San Fran to Los Angeles or something, I don't know.
Yeah, that wasn't really conceivable, really.
He's been going on. It's just everything Musk says he's going to do, all these projects. He just says, that's not going to happen, that's not happening. But he did a live stream a couple of months ago, didn't he, when SpaceX did something genuinely a real breakthrough. And he was caning it while it was happening and just sort of petered off as it succeeded. It's like, no, you've not really thought this through. What if it goes right? So, yeah.
Well, I was just listening. Now, Ike is someone that I've, you know, it's actually quite funny. If you see vintage footage of him, he's wearing these hilarious 80s tracksuits and stuff like that. Like, why are you on TV dressed like that? What the fuck are you thinking? But he seemed to be, I mean, it's weird. I think he was a journalist in the first place. He was working in media in some way. And then he got into this. And I think he said that, and you know, it does sound like some sort of schizophrenia, but he said that he saw, I think it was Ted Heath, but instead of Ted Heath, he saw a lizard. Or something like that. There's some incident that kickstarted all of this.
Ted Heath is a pedo, apparently.
He can see him in pedo form. There you go. It wasn't schizophrenia, it was accurate. I went to see David Icke speaking at Brixton Academy, quite a big venue. I think he's done Wembley Arena as well, but he does these speeches. It was 8 hours. I'm not joking. It had 2 hour long intermissions, but it was 8 hours in total. And I wasn't there the whole time. But he said, it was about 6 hours of talking. And even then he said, I don't really have time today to get onto the reptilians thing. But he did make one remark about it. And it was roughly what you said a minute ago, Woz. It was that if you could perceive these ruling elites as they are, so if you had available to you, which any animal doesn't, but the full range of perception, you would see that their true nature is reptilian, that they're sort of I don't even know what he means by that. Like what, like on the light spectrum or something? I don't know. Like what the fuck are you talking about? But yeah, it's just kind of twaddle. But he says it's a question of perception. You should be able, like, if you saw their true nature, they're inhuman. They're not. They don't really feel anything. They have no regard for other humans and stuff. So that's why the reptilian. But I assume he means he literally saw a reptile. But the time I saw it, they made a documentary about it as well. And he's a quite an eccentric guy because he walks off stage in the documentary. This is the same gig I was at. Walks off stage, walks back to his like dressing room, and the first thing he does is open a can of Super Tennent's, like 9 or 10% Tennent's. Tennent's not a very nice beer anyway, right? And I was like, David Icke's a Super Tennent's drinker. That's how he like chills out after the show with a can of super strength lager. Like, what? What an odd guy. He wasn't wearing a tracksuit.
Fuck hell. Yeah, like, but by the way, I completely believe in the alien invasion that's happening right now. I do.
Oh, is this New Jersey?
Well, everywhere. There's fucking there's footage everywhere. Go on.
So if the Falklands, the next Falklands War is actually against the ETs.
Look, so let's put this aside. If aliens came here now, hypothetical. What would the response be from humanity? What do you think?
Just fuck this. Let's go somewhere else.
I think the full spectrum.
I think it would be like thanks some God, people... you've arrived. We've not been doing well. Please mess everything up a bit.
Yeah, but look, if aliens came down, we don't like what you've been doing. Okay, whatever. We're going to take over.
We don't like the trannies.
Well, this is why I support AI, because I think AI is going to like whip that shit out. But yeah,
that'd be funny. Well, the aliens come down. The first thing they say is, "Right, stop it with all this tranny shit."
Yeah,
that's a
yeah.
cul-de-sac. That's yeah, wrong.
It's a bit too weird, even for us.
Yeah,
we've got to step in and stop you doing all this tranny shit. Fuck's sake.
Yeah,
we like all the bonking. We like seeing people having it off normal style.
Look at that's fine. Yeah, that's the one.
It'd be funny if their message was "Be more normal, guys."
There you go. Be more normal. Yes.
Find the aliens.
Stop being fags. Yeah.
I found the original photo. See, so this is the original photo of. I don't know when that looks like the. I mean, I think that's Reagan and George Bush Senior there. So I'm guessing this is mid or late 80s, and then that was. Transformed into this. So there we go. Just for anyone who's curious.
George Bush is always mentioned as being one of these sort of like he's part of one of the key bloodlines, right? And he was head of the CIA, obviously. And the Bush, but you know, his father tried to stage a coup as well, didn't he? You know about this?
The United Prescott Fruit Bush. Company.
Was he involved in that as well?
Yeah, United Fruit, yeah.
Yeah, and like Prescott Bush, his dad, I think, tried to stage a coup in the 30s, part of the business plot or something. I think.
So, fucking hell. What about the guys in the Titanic, you know, the ones that were opposed to the Federal Reserve and they sank?
This is what Robert Sepper says, isn't it? That like people. But I think, well, why? Like, if you wanted to just stop, why not just murder them? Also, why do they sink in the ship? Like, I don't understand that.
Yeah,
that's a really, really elaborate Poirot plot that you have to sink the entire ship.
Yeah. Still, though, it's pretty good. It's good. It's good.
One thing I will say though about drones is I saw quite a good podcast. I thought it was a fairly good podcast with that Dominic Cummings. Talking to
Winnie. Winnie Marshall, Winston Marshall.
Fucking hell.
You know Chris Williamson?
Oh, sorry.
Oh, yes.
Dominic Cummings sat down with Chris Williamson, or it was over at Zoom or whatever. And
I met Chris Williamson. Yeah, go on.
He seems all right, yeah. And Dominic Cummings, at one point the conversation got onto drones. And Chris Williamson says to Dominic Cummings, like, what is the government's plan or contingency or countermeasures for drones? Like, what's to stop some crazy Chinese person or Iranian or just some anarchist 15-year-old sitting in St. James's Park with a super fast, souped up suicide drone just flying into the Prime Minister's face? when he walks out of Downing Street one day. And Dominic Cummings goes...
I hope it happens.
He goes, nothing. There's nothing. There's no contingency plan. There's no planning. There's nothing. We just hope it doesn't happen. And then one day something like that will happen and they'll start to do countermeasures and et cetera, et cetera. But as it stands right now, there is nothing. And I thought that was surprising to me. I would have thought right. You give these people more credit than they're due very often. I don't know.
Fuck that, you.
Drone warfare. Drone and anti-drone warfare is the future.
Isn't that so depressing? Because it means that there's no room for heroism or, you know, chivalry or anything like that. Because it's just going to be some fucking buzzy drone like thing flying out of the sky. And I mean, I hate this footage that you see from Ukraine and all the, and Gaza, where it's some guy cowering in a room and this drone is just sort of hovering towards and then it does the thing. It's fucking awful.
Yeah, really inhuman, isn't it? And you know, like the really fast drones, really fast ones that just like go, whew. Right. So like the last thing you might not even see or hear anything, but the last thing you might hear is just like that little whiz of drone, tiny little drone servers coming for you like that. And that's the last thing you hear. You don't even hear the explosion that kills you. I mean, yeah. Talk about terrifying.
Yeah. Oh, that's awful. Well, look, on that happy note, I think we should probably answer some super chats because they have been coming in thick and fast throughout this stream. And I sort of neglected them because the conversation was so, free flowing and I didn't want to interrupt it. So, Mr. Webster.
Sorry, Colin. Can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Before we do that, I want to say, and this might seem petty, but since Bo is part of the Lord Seers.
You've been pissed then.
I'm a little bit. Yeah, a little bit. But you know, alcohol is the truth serum.
Festive period. It's good.
It is, yes.
Go ahead, hit me with your best shot. What you got?
No, you've got the Islander magazine.
Yeah.
All right. I think I did that before you.
Well, it was had a different name.
Yeah.
Well, had a different name.
Oh, okay. Didn't we? Yeah. Weren't you published in the Islander?
No.
Weren't you?
I did the Iconoclast magazine. It was there for 3 years before you did it.
Okay, because Raw Egg Nationalist also does a mag, doesn't he?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I actually had nothing to do with the genesis of Islander magazine, so I can't take any responsibility, I'm afraid. But.
Oh, what a cop-out. Yes.
Absolute cop-out.
I enjoy it. The Lotus East have a magazine, The Islander, great. Fantastic. Okay,
cool. Thank you very much. Yeah.
All right. Okay, Mr. Webster.
We know where the real magazine comes from. That's fine.
It's magazine.
All right. Mr. Webster says, I really believe we should research and understand the Zionist network that pays Gentiles like Elon, Rogan, Peterson and Robinson on what to say and what to tweet at the right time, and whether we should see these bank statements of monthly income from them and whether it gets taxed. Well, yeah, I mean, it would be nice, but that's obviously never going to happen. I mean, I take the point, but... you know, all of this stuff is, you know, it's just not going to happen. I'm sorry. It would be nice to know, but I think you can surmise this stuff fairly easily. And indeed, if it turned out that Peterson and Robinson, if it turned out that they weren't getting paid by Zion, that would actually make it worse, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. So either way, it's bad. So I don't think we really need to know that they're getting paid by Ezra Levant or whatever. But, of course, they obviously are. And now Peterson and Tim Pool are certainly getting paid by Ben Shapiro. That's known for a fact.
Fucking Tim Pool, my God.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me started.
Jesus Christ, I forgot about him. Oh, my goodness me.
How to perfectly fulfill the word selling out.
Jesus, he is going for it, isn't he? Big time.
Jesus.
I don't
think he got a lot of money though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can build another skate park with it.
Get his hair back.
So anyway, I'm being such a snob here. Okay, the Woodlander said, thanks for hosting these guys. Big fan of Bo, Dan and Horace. All great Brits. Well, thank you very much, Woodlander.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
big
you.
Fan of you, Woodlander. Hail.
Yeah, yeah. Lovely stuff.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Alt White said, best wishes from across the pond. Thank you very much. End of the line, Joel said, invite Francis Foster onto Millennial next year. He has good a lot luck. To say, apparently. Yes. Well,
good idea. I won't listen, but yeah.
I think it would be a very difficult interview to have, a very difficult conversation to have, because there's just not that much there,
but,
I'm afraid.
No, but trigonometry exists to have difficult conversations. Have you not been listening?
He wouldn't have the arsehole to come on here. I'd put money on he wouldn't have the balls to ante up and come on here and talk to you.
Well, he'll have been listening to this anyway. They've heard us slagging him off, so he's definitely not.
Did you know his mother's Venezuelan? Did you know that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He has mentioned that.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I think he's half English and half Venezuelan. So, yeah, a classic mix there.
Fag. So,
Darby said, interesting this revisiting of the foundations of the DR in Britain from Woe's perspective, beginning to modern day. Well, yeah, I could have gone into a lot more depth, but the thing is, there will be other people who have their own perspective on it. I try to remember things accurately, but it is actually quite difficult because, you know, the memory fades. I mean, it's it is actually quite a long time ago now. This is
every now and then Andy Nowicki does a video about that or talks about it in an interview, and his reminiscences about back then is quite interesting because he was part of that alternative right website and stuff. And I personally I like all the sort of, I don't know what you call it, like the movement genealogy, so to speak.
Yeah, the lore.
It colours in the picture for me. Like, I don't like having gaps in the knowledge. So.
Yeah. I understand. All right, Diesel Runaway said, this has genuinely been one of my favorite ever millennial threads. Made me laugh out loud repeatedly and had me nodding along. Woz needs a drag name in light of his identity revelation. millennial Woz. Yes, well, there's already Wozette. Some people did... before this AI thing really took off, there was an app, I think an Instagram app, that could change sex. So there was an Instagram, Snapchat filter. I mean, so there was an Instagram profile of photos of me, gender swapped. So that's some hilarious thing there that people can go and look at. I think it was called Wozette. Can't remember now, as I certainly had nothing to do with it. So, and that's actually the truth. I really didn't have anything to do with it. Okay, Diesel, she also said, shout out to Padfa. He's a gem of a mod, to be fair. He gets amongst it, as the Welsh would say. Buy him a pint from me. Well, thank you very much. And Padfa has been a really great help to me this year. I mean, he's helped me in the past as well. But this year, I think he's been probably the most dedicated and reliable mod on Millennial. So, yes, indeed, big shout out to Padfa. Thank you very much. Mr. Webster said, I really believe you should invite on next Millennial an Australian white nationalist named Tom Sewell from Australia. He's the most solid white nationalist I've seen in a long time. Maybe I'll look into that. Obviously, I've heard of him, but I don't know much about Australia. The thing about the Australians is they do tend to be very, what's the word? Like, they'll just say things very overtly, you know.
I've never wanted to go to Australia, by the way. That's never been a thing.
Well, what about Ramsey Street? Would you like to visit Ramsey Street?
No.
No? Oh, dear, I think I would. Just to see it.
Yeah, you can remember Lord of the Rings, that was New Zealand, right? Lord of the Rings, Pete Jackson.
Oh, that was New Zealand, yeah.
Yeah. The capital city, whatever it was. But Australia, no, I just hot England, no.
What if Holly Valance personally invited you? Or, that's a bit of an old reference. She's probably about 45 now, but you know, like what?
Kylie Minogue can fuck off.
What about Danny Minogue? She was hotter.
She was the best one, yeah.
She was the raunchy one, the saucy one.
Oh, Danny. Oh.
Clearly, there was something lacking behind her eyes. She was a bit
everyone, fancied everyone fancied Annalise on Neighbours. Do you remember
that? Yes. Oh, hell yeah. Still do.
I never watched Soap Opera's Wars.
Well, it was on before. It was on between Children's BBC and the news, the 6 o'clock news.
Oh, so Madrid, Danny Minogue, come on over.
Do you remember when Annalise Crawley had a little fling with Lou and he became infatuated with her and then she dumped him because he was like 50-odd?
I don't remember that plot, but...
Lou was a nice guy.
Horace, what the fuck are you talking about? It's crazy. What is going on here?
That happened.
Neighbours nostalgia. A lot of people won't have any idea what we're talking about.
This is the distant right, by the way.
Yeah.
She was gorgeous, I'll say that. Anyway, let's move on.
There were quite a few cute girls in Neighbours, I've got to say.
Holly Valance, yes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. All right. So, okay. Construct.
Wouldn't mind being her neighbour. Worry. Sorry.
Good friend. All right. Construct says, I disagree with history, bro. I'd say the war was fairly catastrophic, but could have been healed. Rather less dramatic, the Treaty of Versailles and the Balfour Declaration were more pernicious and terminal to Europeans. Well, the Treaty of Versailles probably did set up World War II. But then World War II itself could have been avoided easily. I mean, you know.
It sort of suggests, doesn't it, that the Balfour Declaration and the Treaty of Versailles would not have occurred without World War I happening. Almost certainly. Or, I mean, who knows? Counterfactuals, who knows how history could have gone differently. But, yeah, if it was, you know, there would have been no Treaty of Versailles. It wouldn't have existed, would it?
Exactly. But also just the monarchies and the aristocracies, the dynasties of Europe, they were all just dismantled, torn apart by World War I. So that...
Yeah, it saw the end of the Tsarist regime, the Russian Empire, of course, the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire was terribly undermined, the German Empire was killed.
The
Austro-Hungarian Empire came to an end. In all sorts of ways... That was the dynamite, and we're still living in the explosion of it, I feel.
Yeah.
And Germany and Austria and Hungary nearly fell to Marxism as well. Left-leaning republics as well.
Yeah, that's something that's not often talked about, that Germany had this communist uprising, I think in 1919.
It was 12 or something, yeah, loads.
Yeah.
So, What's the better film, 1917 or the remake of All Quiet on the Western Front?
Oh, I would say All Quiet on the Western Front. They're both good. They're both worth watching, absolutely.
Yeah.
But for actually, they're very different films. They both happen to be set and about World War One, but they're very, very different storytelling and everything. Yes. I would advise people to see both. But I did quite like the new All Quiet on the Western Front.
Oh, I totally agree. Thank you for agreeing with me. Yes, totally. Full on.
All right. And then Rogue Trader.
Well, I haven't seen it. Nobody's seen this.
Okay. Spill the beans, Bo. Did any of the Lotus Eaters get their hands on that Charlie Chick's huge milkers?
Oh, God.
That's a rather indecent question to ask. I don't know who this Charlie chick is, but hopefully...
Charlie Dimmock? Wait, sorry, what?
No, not Charlie Dimmock, surely.
God, it was a bit of a mountain out of a molehill, really. There was that girl, Charlie... well, she's got a double-barreled name.
Oh, Bentley Astor?
Yeah, Charlie Bentley Astor came on.
Oh, and, yes, I remember this girl.
And
yes.
She's a woman that owns breasts, right? Uh-huh. And so some of the people in our chat, I think, and on Twitter were just mentioning her breasts.
Cool.
She got a bit pissed off about it and moaned a bit about it. And that's it. It's pretty much a nothing burger.
Right, okay.
Put the demands to bed.
Pretty much all that happened. So
okay,
it's not
sorry,
really
I didn't know about that. History.
Yeah. Very, very small affair.
Okay.
But big boobs, yeah?
Okay. And then Construct also said, Scrump Monkey are the containment analyst specialists. Personal proclivities notwithstanding, they have a track record of accurate political forecasts. Well, yes, that is true. Their coverage is very good. All right. And then there were some super chats here as well. Unit Tactics. I think Musk's autistic outburst is highlighting to people that we're going right back. What, 2 hours here? Sorry, that's my fault. I think Musk's autistic outburst is highlighting to people that no immigration is good, that an immigrant who looks like you can be 1,000 times more disastrous for your nation than one who doesn't. Yep, this is the other side of it all, that someone like him, who in theory should be very sympathetic to us, is actually working against us, and it's fucking depressing. Okay, the Enrieb said, Kissin and Peterson are like the ants giving out a faulty pheromone trail that leads the other ants into the ant death spiral. Sorry to keep going on about ant mills, but I think there's something relevant in the phenomenon. Smarter chaps than me might expand on the analogy to Western civilization. Well, yeah, I think that it's a general point that you get these people who are like the Pied Piper of Hamelin, and they're just leading everyone to shit. But they're doing it for whatever reason. I mean, in the case of Kissin, you know why. In the case of Peterson, it's rather more ambiguous, and it's sort of interesting to speculate why do they do that. It's a crazy thing to do, but anyway, then moving on, Gus Mooney said, I'd like to hear Walt. Sorry?
I'm still thinking about the big boobs. Oh. Sorry, move on.
All right. Okay. Gus Mooney said, I'd like to hear Woz have a chat with Graham Moore of the English Constitution Party. He has a very rational plan on how we can regain control of the home nations by using the Constitution to declare the Acts of Union null and void from 1707. I mean, that's, I don't know. It would be interesting to talk to him, but this strikes me as the kind of thing that could and should work, but in reality just won't work unless you've got massive power and money behind you. Then you could make this case, but otherwise you're not going to just uproot 300 years of history. It's just not going to happen. I'm sorry. But having said that, I'd be perfectly prepared to hear him out. It's just, I think that's the practical reality of it.
What's his thoughts on tits?
Let's just get through these super chats and then we'll talk about breasts a bit more.
We'll get to the tits later.
Yes. Okay. The Enrieb said, given Elon's backing of reform, will Farage and reform import infinite Indians?
Yes.
Predictions, gentlemen? Here's a question for you all. Do you think that Farage and reform are going to be involved in the next government of this country? Or is it going to be a nothing burger that burns out and it's going to return to the old pendulum between Labour and Conservative?
I'll go with yes, they will. It's not just a flash in the pan. It's not just going to burn out, but it is basically just going to be another Tory party. But yeah, there might be some sort of coalition between them and the Tories. That does seem like quite possible.
All right, Bo, what do you think?
I'm not entirely sure. I think if Nige and Tyus keep going down the same avenue, they'll max out at about 20%, which maxes out at about the number of MPs they got now. Maybe a few more, maybe they'll get 10, 15, maybe as many as 20, 25 MPs. I don't think they'll be forming any part of the next government, I'm afraid. The amount of shit I talk about reform, I still want the furthest leaning right parties to do well still in order to shift the Overton window, if nothing else. So I don't wish them the worst, but I don't see them getting enough MPs next time to be certainly to be the government in their own right or even to sort of form any sort of coalition. I'm afraid. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that take looks bad in 4 years' time. But
honestly, I think that if they just went for it, and started, you know, really going on the anti-immigration thing, I think they'd have a far more success than they're going to have. Dan, what do you think?
I think that I think they'll be basically the Conservative Party part two. I think Farage will ultimately be the the Tory leader. That's what I think. And you know, all he has to do is be more hardline, but he won't do it. So I think there'll be a merge. It'll be very disappointing. That's what I think.
Right. Okay. What I can say is that Nigel Farage does agree with you guys about milkers. Here is a little scene image of him that was taken a few years ago. It's absolutely outrageous.
I suspect that that's not what was originally on that piece of paper. I don't know about you guys.
But... No way.
Oh,
100% real.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm a bit cynical, but jaded these days.
All right.
The Aryan bit in particular.
Not white. Not particularly white. They could be tanned, but they must be Aryan genetically.
And Nigel agrees because he's just as he's a complete white supremacist. Dreadful man.
Base nudge.
Hidden power levels.
All right. Darby, question for the panel. Which Anglosphere country do you think has the worst normies? I'd say Canada. Geo's documented this well on Twitter. Geo will be appearing on the next banquet, by the way, in a couple of hours. So which of them has the worst normies?
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
it's a good question.
I'd say America, actually. Yeah, I'd say the US.
It depends what you mean by worst. I think if you mean the most sort of brainwashed, then...
Because of the whole MAGA thing, they're like, oh, MAGA is unlimited Indians, legally. That's it. I think that's all. In Europe, it's more visceral. In Europe, it's like, oh, we can see the effect of these people coming here. In America, it's almost detached because they're going to work in big tech. And that's it.
There are a lot of, I mean, you'd certainly hear from a lot of Americans who really buy into all this rubbish that Musk will talk about. Yeah. So,
yeah.
But I mean, I would just say New Zealand produced Jacinda Ardern.
She's not dead now.
I hope so. Yeah. You hear that story. Not very festive, but yeah, I stand by that anyway.
Whoa, buddy. Come on.
Oh, well, if that's illegal, I retract it, but only if it's legal. It's in all seriousness, if that is endangering your channel or anything, woes.
What? That Jacinda Ardern is dead? As far as I know, she's alive, isn't she?
No, I said I hope so.
Oh, no, no. I
think purely in jest.
Obviously, no one wants that. Yeah, of course, I think it's understood. That's just humor.
I hope she's alive and well.
She was attractive 10 years ago.
Well, actually, I have a meme for that as well. Unbelievably.
Oh, really?
I don't have that many about Jacinda, but...
She was a hot girl.
Yeah. Here we go.
Are we going to see him? Oh, no.
Oh, shit. Oh, my. Oh, wow. Fucking hell. Whoa.
She looks like she's had a meth habit.
Yeah.
It looks like... It looks like the mugshots of the same perp over 15 years, and their crack has just ravished their face further and further.
She started off as this nice, wholesome, middle-class girl, and then by the end of it, you know, complete wreck.
Time is a hell of a bitch, I tell you, though.
I like
no,
how...
There's no escaping it.
I like
especially
how
the women, let's face it.
I like how History Bro said perp in a real way. He used the word perp in a proper sentence. Fucking hell.
Bad, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. My God.
Well, I would say, in terms of the worst normies, it might actually be the Scots, because they are so fucking, like, just airy-fairy progressives. You know, I was going to say the Canadians, but then the Canadians did do the trucker convoy thing, so a lot of them are obviously okay. But the Scots, I don't know. Difficult.
With the Celtic nations, like the smaller Celtic nations, you get that thing of like just they please themselves by defining themselves in opposition to England, right?
Oh, yeah.
So Scotland, I bet, has that. Obviously, Wales has that in spades. There's plenty of genuine, like, good people all over these countries, but Yeah, there's that element, that Celtic resentment thing.
That syndrome is everywhere. I mean, New Zealand does it in reference to Australia. Canada does it in reference to the United States. Yeah. And obviously, Ireland and Scotland, especially Scotland, do it in reference to England. So it's a definite thing. Like they see it as they've got to be more progressive than the big brother that they resent. So, you know, that's how they get cachet. And it probably does work. On the globalist sort of stage, that probably does get them plaudits. Yeah. All right.
I've got family in Wales, and I love Wales, but, I mean, the quality of politicians they produce is like another level lower than English politicians. They're, like, even noticeably worse. Like, it's horrible. I'm sure it's the same in Scotland as well.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, these are people who, I've said it before, these are people who should have been, like, local councillors, but because of devolution, the parliament's there, so they've become politicians.
And they're people who should have been banned from being local councillors, yeah.
Well, yeah. They couldn't do much damage there, at least at that level, but they shouldn't even have been there. I mean, it's a really depressing thing, because if you look at the people who were there at the start of the Scottish Parliament, like Donald Dewar, for example, there were others as well, but he's the one that springs to mind. They were actually men of a different caliber. I mean, the people there now are just plebs. They really are. They're getting no. They're just not. Statesmen is just laughable. But anyway, yeah. And then finally, a very generous super chat from Alex. And he says, "Great streams, brother. All the best in the new year. Thanks for everything you do." Well, thank you very much, Alex. I'm glad you're enjoying it. all right.
Before we sign off, sorry.
No, that's fine. I just don't want to keep you, around.
Well, look, I'm just spitballing. So I watched one of your streams a couple of weeks ago, and you were talking about the afterlife, right? And I think I'm not particularly religious, but people are, and they the afterlife is a big thing. What's heaven? What's hell? What is the afterlife? You were talking about reincarnation, Colin, I think. And you said that you would enjoy that in a certain paradigm. I think reincarnation would be the worst thing ever if it was real. Because, okay, reincarnation. Oh, you might be reincarnated into an eagle flying through the sky, the big predator in the air. Or maybe a killer whale. The likelihood is you'd be reincarnated into an Indian man, right?
And Indian man with an H one.
Yeah, it's just an Indian guy. Oh, and that's it. And I thought, well, okay. That's why I hate reincarnation as an idea.
I see what you mean. It really depends on the allocation of, future lives to each soul. Like, is there an ascending, or can you just be...
Look at the population increase of India. I mean, there's lots of jobs to be taken up there.
Yeah.
You'd rather just be fucking dead, wouldn't you, really?
Oh,
I agree that some sort of never-ending cycle of life would be like hell.
Hell on earth.
I'm, for one, looking forward to oblivion on some level. Finally.
I'd rather be a termite. I'd rather be a fucking woodlice. I'd rather just stay fucking dead than be an Indian man.
Jesus Christ. All right, let's sign off there. Let's sign off there before you say anything that's going to get us all arrested.
Well, thank Merry you Christmas, everyone. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Okay. It's been a very nice stream, very easy going, and I hope you've all enjoyed it.
Until the very end, yes.
All right.
I just want to say I hope Jacinda Ardern is alive and well. And Charlie, if you want to get him out, just get him out. All right, let's go.
Yeah.
Excellent. I will see you all in about 40 minutes for the Canadian banquet. Hope you've enjoyed this one. Bye-bye for now.
Ciao.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Commemorating 10 years of Millennial, This unique animated vector graphic is available as an NFT for one lucky owner, and only one. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.